Live to Rise, our brand new number one from Soundgarden. That's it for us this week. Thanks to Billy Duffy from The Cult for checking in with us. TheCult.us is their website. You can get all the information on their new album and tour dates coming up. Our site is TheSideshowCountdown.com.
Get caught up on the entire chart right there. We'll see you next week.
I'm Nikki Sigg.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
See ya.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Well, thank you very much. Hi, Jolene.
Hi, Peter.
Just back from the battlefields of the anti-NATO demonstrations in Chicago.
Yes, it was a whirlwind. I promised a report.
And I wonder, I hope people even know, you know, I get the feeling that a lot of people don't even know that demonstrations happened. A lot of people don't even know what NATO is.
Well,
so we got some explaining to do.
Peter, the second part is totally true. But, I mean, I think it got a lot of media attention. And more people who I expected not to know. So that's good.
Well, we may get some help. In fact, I know we're going to get some help. Joining us in the studio is singer-songwriter David Rovix. Hi, David. Oh, I mean, this is the kind of thing you're going to, next you want a mic, huh? Okay.
Oh, a mic.
There you are.
There you go. Good.
Yeah, David Rovix, old friend of Jolene and mine. And, in fact, we go back quite a ways. Even we were all together. Last time we were all together, I wasn't in Chicago, was in 2001 when we were in Miami.
2003, yeah.
Was it 2003?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was.
Okay.
2001 was a different one.
Okay. I can't keep. So many demonstrations. So I'm not exactly sure where we should start. Here's the basics of it, though. There was a meeting of NATO. NATO is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, but I think like a lot of stuff, like United States Steel and stuff, they just call it U.S. Steel. I don't, because the membership in NATO is so diverse now. It's like Turkey and, I don't know, all these, and these central European countries that really have nothing to do with the North Atlantic. And it's sort of at a loss in a way because NATO doesn't have any enemies anymore. But, in fact, here is what David N. Gibbs said. David N. Gibbs is the author of First Do No Harm, Humanitarian Intervention and the Destruction of Yugoslavia. And he said, NATO is an organization that has lost its relevance with the Cold War. Some of you may remember that. Other than just in, from your history books. It was originally created to protect Europe against the military invasion by the Soviet Union. I can say parenthetically, that was never, ever going to happen. So right from its origins, it was a fake construction. David N. Gibbs says, by any reasonable standard, it should simply have ceased to exist with the end of the Cold War in 1989. So that's a long time ago. Today is largely an example of bureaucratic self-preservation as well as a drain on the economy.
Yeah, that is the one argument that people have been using with me, why NATO is good. And I said, well, why? That was then, and this is now. This is 2012.
Well, our guest, David Rovick, singer-songwriter, who has just come back from a tour of Europe.
Are we going to let him get a word in edgewise?
No, well, I'll talk for him. I'm perfectly
at you.
Listen, I know David. Once he gets going, I'm through. I'm through. I talked with my wife about not even coming, just letting the two of you do it. But David's been on a tour of Europe. He's in the United States, which he continually tours. Also was at the anti-NATO demonstrations in Chicago. And also, David, you played at a Palestinian event tonight, correct?
I did.
Which was
at the Hyatt. It was the anniversary of the Nakba, which is the great disaster, which is what the Palestinians call the founding of the State of Israel.
Now, you're not a Palestinian. How did you wind up playing for them?
Writing songs about Palestinians. The more songs I write about Palestinians, the more Palestinians I meet. And so it's a vicious cycle.
And you've been there several times, right?
Only sort of one and a half times, really.
Okay.
And you don't mean vicious in a negative manner.
No.
Right. It may have come off that way.
It's a cycle. It's a nice cycle, really.
Yeah. Right.
But let's tell people what we're doing here and ask them if they'd like to join. This is Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Our guest is singer-songwriter David Rovick. If you'd like to call in, our number is 313-298-WRIF.
It's 313-298-9743.
That's one of her jobs.
That's my job.
That's good.
She has several jobs.
We have a Facebook. We always want likes. It's facebook.com/nightcall. We'll have a podcast available at noon on Monday. That's tomorrow. And Athena and Sarah are waiting to get your calls at 313-298-WRIF. And let's talk a little more about NATO, because I have my little piece of paper. I watched ABC tonight. I would say, okay, how has this been being presented on the media? Well, on ABC, they explained that the demonstrators were there because they were anti-NATO. I mean, that was it.
That was it?
Yeah. And then
pretty
they had some
stuff.
And you know how I always say, so the people are presented in these demonstrations like this. Demonstrators clashed with police, which means, of course, that the cops kicked the crap out of a bunch of people that weren't, were going someplace the police didn't like. People still show up in shorts and flip-flops, and the police are all suited up RoboCop, right?
Yeah, and little old ladies with walkers. Yeah.
Well, okay, you're right. I'm going to let you. Okay, I'll turn it over. I'll tell you what. You interview David.
No, Peter, don't make me interview. We'll interview David.
Well, you guys were at this protest, and tell us some about it. I mean, what was its goals? Because it's not presented on ABC or NBC or CBS. One line was in the New York Times. It said that it was a range of issues upset with the war in Afghanistan, climate change, and the erosion of union rights. Thousands of demonstrators. David Rovick, how many people are reported to have been in today's demonstration?
I don't know about the reports. I would say there were definitely several thousand. I don't know, but beyond exactly.
We had to leave before people were still streaming in.
They were still coming.
We left.
Yeah.
So it was a good crowd. Definitely.
I mean, when you say thousand, I mean 3,000, 20,000. Yeah, it looked huge.
I would say less than 10,000 when we left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could have been more. I did see some shots. If I can pull this up pretty quickly. And you guys can see it. But Associated Press, which does a lot of lot better reporting than a lot of sources. It says protesters and police clashed on Sunday in the most fractious confrontation yet following a series of weekend protests. A video captured officers striking a group of protesters repeatedly with batons.
Well, what happened from what I read is it was just a small group and it was mostly peaceful except for this group of people, and I don't know how it ensued, but the protesters were throwing things at the cops, and then the cops came at them. That's how that went. But otherwise, I guess it was pretty peaceful.
Yeah, well, that's good.
I predicted that.
Yeah, and how much did they spend? I heard $10 million in security and cops. And
well, that's very cheap in 2010 in Toronto.
Yeah.
When it met there.
Or maybe it was $20
million. $1 billion. They spent
$1 billion in Toronto, and people just... Every time I mention that statistic, people, including people who really know about this kind of stuff, and like, you know, how much, like Anne Wright, I was just talking with, you know, Colonel Anne Wright, a 29-year military veteran, former ambassador, you know, she has a good idea about how much things cost, you know, and she couldn't believe that Toronto spent $1 billion. She thought it must have been a typo or something, but they did. Yeah. So, yeah, this is relatively cheap, you know, as these things go.
And the Toronto police were completely out of control to the point that a police investigation, I've rarely ever seen this, said the police acted in total disregard, this is in Toronto, in 2010, for civil and constitutional rights, exceeded their authority, arrested people unnecessarily. And whenever anybody thinks about Chicago, they think of Chicago 1968 and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, the whole world is watching, and how brutal the Chicago police were. But so you guys didn't see any of that. It looked, they only had like 18 arrests.
Yeah, well, while we were there, I don't think we saw much in the way of any police brutality. Actually, the police were being very nice.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, as these things go with all these kind of protests, there's always all this hype before it about how all these people are coming to do terrible violence and the police are going to have to deal with them with violence and all this. It's all meant to keep everybody away from the protest, I think, is the whole idea there.
Well,
and to justify lots of spending.
And it worked. It worked because it was a ghost town, just like when we were in Miami in 2003.
There was no one
downtown except
people
for
left. The people who lived there left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everywhere we went, we would hear people saying, "I live there. I'm out of here." And there was no reason to even do that.
No.
It was ridiculous.
I have this article from Chicago CBS. The security plan shuts down roads South Loop for NATO summit weekend. So they pretty much locked down the entire city.
It didn't seem like it whatsoever, though, didn't?
No, they shut down certain roads and intersections and certain highway exits, but it was still easy to get around, and there was hardly any cars.
Right, some buses weren't running, but no one had a problem getting there.
No.
We drove right in.
What do they have in the country? In fact, you know,
in the country? Why? What are you talking about?
So we can protest in prettier places.
Yeah.
I prefer to protest in pretty places.
Yeah, better than the smog. You're right.
NATO has met in the United States 23 times. This is the first time it's met outside of Washington, D.C. And it probably all was as a favor to the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel.
And you know how we thanked him. I mean, the favor, he got thanked, but... for our favor, by everyone marching to his house yesterday, right, David?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you guys go there?
No.
He had a pretty modest house. Did you see the
photo? I know. It looked kind of cheap, really, with the air conditioning kind of unit kind of sticking out of the third floor window. It looked like it was going to fall out.
It's all a ruse.
Now, the big the big story in the major media, it was that there was a number of arrests, people accused of terrorism, that they were making bombs, and that was two held on terrorism charges, and
Well, David is pretty fired up about this. In fact, he's been writing a song. I don't think it's ready yet.
It's not ready yet.
But go ahead.
Well, I mean, of course, there's plenty of people out there who actually would, by their own initiative, make and throw Molotov cocktails. It is a fairly, you know, common global tradition. But in this particular case, it was two undercover cops who sort of started hanging out in this group house with some Occupy activists and that were hosting a bunch of out-of-town guests who were there for the protests. And these two cops were the ones who actually bought the all the materials for making the Molotov cocktails, brought them to the apartment, and then once they were in the apartment, at that point, there was the raid and the arrests of these people who supposedly were also involved with pouring the gasoline into the bottles. But the police bought them all. So that's, you know, it seems like, and it's consistent with every other case since 9/11 of busting supposed terrorists in the U.S., which is that these are not terrorist busts. They create the terrorist cell in the first place, and then they bust them.
Sure. The lawyers for the defendants said the men were entrapped and that a man and a woman who were either informants or undercover law enforcement officials had come up with the plans and provided the materials for explosives, and they thought that the arrests were intended to assure that large numbers of people wouldn't attend the gathering.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was all to try to keep people away at the last minute, I'm sure.
You're listening to Night Call. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan are guests in the studio. Just back from the anti-NATO protests in Chicago, singer-songwriter David Rovics. You can go to David's website, David Rovics, RovicsR.com, and hundreds of free downloads, right?
Yeah, my latest CD they can download in one click there. It's called Big Red Sessions and lots of other stuff.
How many songs do you think you've written this week?
Yeah.
I wasn't going to ask him about his life. This is an incredible, I mean, actually, David Rovics is sort of like the troubadours of old because they're topical songs. I remember one time I asked you at a concert I attended, I asked you to sing a song, and you looked at me so blankly like, hey, man, that was like 10 years ago. That's, yeah. I can't even remember what one it was.
Yeah.
And hundreds of songs, and how you have the capacity, one, to write them, and two, to remember them all.
Well, I don't. That's the thing.
Oh, that's, you know, right.
It's only
now.
Through the iPad that I can remember them.
Modern technology.
I forgot.
I got 100 of them in my brain at any given time, but not. I've written probably like 300. So.
A lot of songs.
This week. You want to join? We got it. Usually we don't take calls right away, but this, I think, is somebody. It was even mentioned on our Facebook page. So I think that we ought to just get him in real quickly. It's Brendan from Southgate.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Brendan. All right, wait a minute. Yeah. Hey, Brendan. Brendan, hi. You're on the air. You with us, man?
Hey, man. What's going on?
Nothing much.
Which Brendan is this?
This is Brendan from Southgate.
Oh, this isn't Brendan the hippie.
Actually, it is, Peter. I have gone through rehab and now I am sober.
You sound so much different, doesn't he, Peter?
Yeah. Well, congratulations. What do you mean rehab? What were you?
I went through rehab, man, and I just got clean and I got a totally different aura on my life now.
Well, yeah. So you're still pro pot though?
I thought you were just doing reef.
Yes.
Man.
Yeah. Yes. No, I had a few more problems.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm glad it's... You know, I hate to tell you this, Brendan, but you're not any fun anymore.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
You're out of here, too.
Call back when you're smoking again, dude.
Yeah. This guy, he's the guy, hey, man.
Yeah, we enjoyed that.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
From time to time.
We probably really hurt his feelings. All right. Back to the NATO meeting. I mean, it's not even clear. I mean, NATO comes to meet, and most people accept that committees of either the national rulers or, in this case, international rulers are meeting, and they talk about stuff that the ordinary people.
And most people think it's important stuff.
And
right?
Don't have any input. And we don't have any input. That is one of the reasons. There's lots of reasons that people demonstrate. One of the reasons that these demonstrations occur, particularly in the United States, but around the world as well, is that's our voice. If there was authentic voice of resistance to some of the plans of these maniacs that have our lives in their hands, we would say, well, cool. We can just watch it on C-SPAN, you know?
Right.
But since it's not there, it then falls to the people. But I kind of like that, too.
Yeah, protesting is more fun anyway. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's been
great fun.
Great fun. But let's see. Chicago officials were also investigating whether the city's official website, which was down early Sunday, had been a target of a cyber attack. Well, can I save them the work? Anonymous took it down.
Yeah,
they did that. But it said thousands of people gathered in the steamy weather in Grant Park along Lake Michigan to protest NATO and its work.
And much more.
But it all kind of ties in together.
But I think they're protesting imperialism, but they don't like to use that word in the mainstream media. So they want to say NATO and its work. What is its work? Work is building empires, isn't it? I mean,
yeah. Well, that's my point. Who
bombing Muslim countries and taking them over?
Somebody, I think, if you said to the ordinary person, what is NATO's work? I don't think you'd get much of an answer.
No, I guess not. I mean, what is the average person? I don't even know. I don't have any idea. Average person in England is somebody who can read and write, and so you have some kind of basis for saying average in a place that has a decent educational system. In this country, I have no idea what average means.
Yeah.
Well, what is an average
person? Well, this sounds terrible, but Mark Twain once said, you know this one, right? Said, consider the intelligence of the average man and realize 50% are even dumber.
That's right. Yeah.
That's kind of, I know, it's an elitist remark. It's an elitist remark. But, you know, big things are happening, people, in the world and hence in our lives. We're at a real cusp. You know, nobody, say, in 1929 or in the 30s, 1941, any year in history that stands out, people didn't go, whoa, this is an historic year. I mean, it was after we judged it, but things that have the potential to alter our lives fundamentally are occurring right now. And we really are at a fairly dismal, and I say we generously, we are at a point where we've got to be engaged, we've got to know what's going on, and lots of folks don't.
Yeah, and I experienced that as I was wandering around the streets and people engaging me in conversation about it.
Talking about Chicago?
Yeah.
Good.
And one guy in particular was standing there. Oh, Peter, you would have loved it. There was this big giant flag just waving in the wind. He's taking a picture, and we were standing at an intersection waiting for the light. And he said, isn't that beautiful? I said, oh, yeah, it's beautiful. I said, hey, have you seen a bunch of bicycling protesters? I was looking for them. And he's like, why, are you a protester? I'm like, yeah, what are you protesting, NATO? NATO's good. NATO's good. I'm like, what's good about it? He couldn't name one thing.
Well, he probably didn't know.
Example A.
It's a symbol of the empire, to use David's word. And so you want to signal allegiance to it, because if you start questioning it, if you start questioning authority, well, then you're a citizen under suspicion.
Yeah.
And people fear that. I wonder if you guys saw any of this. Aaron Hughes and Scott Kimball, they're veterans and members of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and they were going to lead a rally and march on Sunday to the NATO meeting security perimeter. And Scott Kimball said, we plan on returning our medals to the leaders of NATO. It's been destabilizing, not stabilizing Afghanistan. We are against this militarism.
Yep, I watched the whole thing.
Really?
Went down and watched it. Yeah, it was very moving. And about five different service members spoke. And it was, almost moves you to tears what these guys have gone through and what they're willing to do to protest.
And this has echoes, of course, of actions during the Vietnam War, when there was a group called Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and dozens of these guys would go, like, to the White House or the Pentagon and throw all the medals they had gotten for heroism or Purple Hearts mm-hmm. and what have you. I mean, yeah. Feeling used and abused. Let me do this, though. I thought this was a pretty interesting article in the New York Times today, because what we're talking about, folks, if you're just joining us, are these anti-NATO protests that occurred in Chicago over the weekend. I'm Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan with me, as always, David Rovick, singer-songwriter, who was also there.
He's going to do a song or two for us.
Yeah, and sang,
in a minute.
You can keep chilling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And David, from what I hear, Jalene called and said you'd gotten to sing half a song.
Half a song before the sound system completely imploded. And then it took them 2 hours before they got it kind of working again.
And we think it was the work of
intelligence agencies,
yeah.
For sure.
Oh.
Convinced.
No, who knows? But
I thought you were going to say rival singer-songwriters.
Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine and On His Own performed. And what was the last guy?
Rebel Diaz. Professor D.
Professor
D. There were all kinds of Outer Knots or Outer, I don't know, some band from Brooklyn. There was a lot of good musicians there that did not get to play.
little earlier, we were talking about how David Rovich, Jalene Jordan, and myself, Peter Werby, were in Miami in 2003 for the this protest against the free trade, what was it called?
Free Trade Area of the Americas.
Yeah, it was another NAFTA, you know, that was going to do the same thing to us and to them that NAFTA has done to this country. And there was a concert at a sort of a sports arena, and David Rovich, our guest here in the studio, was singing. And then we realized they weren't letting anyone out. And all these other musicians were beating it. They were hightailing it. And David got up and started. And I'm thinking, Victor Jara. Victor Jara. Did you know? Did I ever run this by you? Did you ever think about that? What happened? Another September 11th, which was 1973, I think, was the year. This is when the Kissinger-Nixon overthrow of the Chilean government occurred. Another, you know, set of war crimes that Kissinger and the rest of them should have been at the Hague for. But, and this fascist regime came and they rounded up trade unionists and leftists and anybody they didn't like and put them in this sports stadium. And in fact, David, you know this story better than I do. Can you, pick up on it?
Yeah, they had 5,000 people in the sports stadium and they, and Victor Jara, who was a very well-known songwriter in Chile, that who was a big supporter of the Allende government, he got up to in the stadium to sing for everybody, and then the
they were prisoners
to sing for the other prisoners in there, and then when he started singing, then the guards the first thing they did is break his hands.
And then they began shooting randomly into the crowd. So here, flash to 2003, and David Rovich is singing in this bowl in Miami. The Miami police will not let us out of the bowl, and I'm thinking, you know, Santiago, 1973.
They only went as far as a whole buttload of pepper spray. And I don't know how you sang, because it drifted down.
Oh, that was in
all the
Miami.
Way.
Tear gas. Yeah, lots and lots of tear gas.
So we were just reading that about these anti-NATO protests and their work. And so here's their work. I mean, straight out here. One of the things about the New York Times is that this is a paper, anybody can read it, but essentially it's for the people in the 1% to know thoroughly what's going on. You don't have sports headlines right at, you know, the top there. They want people to know about the economy, about the political trajectory of the country, stuff like that. So President Obama on Sunday will unveil a new package of NATO initiatives that includes the NATO alliance, purchasing a fleet of surveillance drones, sharing weapons and training facilities, and sustaining nuclear deterrence in Europe. Even as disarmament efforts continue with an often belligerent Russia, according to senior administration officials. Now, always that has to be deconstructed. Now, that Russia, you know, they're being just like that old Soviet Union. Maybe we do need this NATO. Well, it turns out, of course, is that the United States, which is like over here, and Russia, which is way over there.
Not according to... What's her name again?
Yeah, we don't mention that. we're putting up this missile defense system in these Eastern European countries. And can you imagine how crazy these Ruskies are? They think it's aimed at them. And we're saying, no, it's aimed at Iran. And then they're saying, well, wait a minute. Iran doesn't have any nuclear weapons, and it doesn't have any missiles. But
go figure.
Yeah, and they would have to decide that I got an idea. Let's send a nuclear missile to the Czech Republic. Or no. I mean, this is all the mullahs are talking. No, let's send it to Slovenia. I mean, this is so insane. And the Russians are absolutely 100% correct. This is aimed at them. And so they're not the belligerent Russia at all. It's the belligerent United States. And we were reading last week. Thank you. This is another job she has.
Your memory.
My memory, yeah. It says that Mitt Romney's recent declaration that Russia is America's top geopolitical adversary. So what do you think the people in Russia must think? Yeah, I mean, so this is their job. It's a central element of Mr. Obama's announcement will be to hand over to NATO control for the components of an emerging European missile defense system built by the United States. A radar station in Turkey will become permanently under the alliance command. In times of crisis, American Navy Aegis warships with radar and interceptor missiles would be transferred to NATO command. When interceptor missiles planned for Poland and Romania are in place, they would also be placed under NATO command in times of crisis. You would actually think it would be the opposite. But what kind of crisis could you imagine? I mean, could it be that there would be a fear of belligerence from Russia? Well, wouldn't it be a better idea to, like, maybe to... What were those old things called?
Negotiations.
Peace treaties.
Even that.
How about that?
Even better.
As the Pentagon reduces the number of army brigades permanently in Europe, never can tell when the Russians may try to invade France, you know, or something like that. The United States will pledge to rotate units through training facilities on the continent so the ability for Allied and American troops to fight side by side is sustained.
There was a lot of anti-Obama sentiment at the rally. I saw a ton of it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He will describe, I mean, just
as upset with him as everybody else.
Mr. Obama also will describe the results of NATO's review of its defense deterrent posture and how the alliance will field a combination of nuclear weapons, missile defenses, and conventional forces to guarantee the security of all members. From who? I mean, that's the question.
Yeah.
Anybody got, oh, you know.
Yeah, someone, hey, wait, what do we have out there?
Phones.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know.
An audience.
I can see through the glass, Athena and Sarah, they're napping.
They're sleeping in there.
Wake them up. What do you think? Let me see. Just a couple more things here. No reductions in NATO's nuclear arsenals will be announced. And NATO nations in Central and Eastern Europe, well, that's so much for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, remain particularly nervous about aggressive talk from Russia's returning president, Vladimir Putin, and want continued assurances of an alliance nuclear umbrella.
Ooh.
Just finally, similarly, the alliance will pledge to continue air patrols over the territory of Baltic nations in NATO so those states do not have to invest in fighter jets. The alliance will also announce initiatives to share maritime patrol aircraft, route clearance vehicles, and medical facilities, as well as pool maintenance costs for helicopters and armored vehicles. One of the things you should be hearing in the background is a lot of ching, 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 ching.
I hear it.
How's your city doing? Anybody laid off there? You know, any?
Yeah. How's your house? Do you still own it?
Yeah. Any? How's your health insurance or your pension? This is where it's going, folks. This is the work of NATO. And that's why our guest, David Rovick, singer-songwriter, and, of course, my pal and co-host, Jalene Jordan, were in Chicago protesting against.
And a whole lot of other people. Thousands.
Well, David Rovick, you know, with me here, you're never really going to get a chance to talk. But I'll bet
I do a lot of talking the rest of the time.
But I'll bet if you sang, I would shut up.
Okay.
We're going to take a commercial break.
We'll take a commercial break, and if you got some calls, we'll take those, too. We'll let Mr. Announcer tell you where to call.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
Have you ever wished your booty was a little more lifted, fuller, rounder? The Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa can make it happen with a Brazilian butt lift.
Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Gray. A Brazilian butt lift is a simple procedure. No implants are used, just your own body fat, giving you a fuller, rounder bottom with no downtime.
Well, that's a plus. So, Dr. Gray, how do you do it?
We take fat from your problem area, which are fat cells that are resistant to diet and exercise, and transfer it to the buttocks and make that area now resistant to diet and exercise.
So you're solving one problem and fixing the other by taking away the fat cells that I don't want and putting them in a place I do want.
We build up the volume of the buttocks, and my patients make a decision when they want to stop.
So each woman determines her final result?
We customize it to each patient.
Fantastic. That's Dr. Michael Gray from the Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa. Call today for a complimentary consultation at 248-538-3333 or visit anewyou.com.
I'm Dr. Michael Gray. Call me today and I'll see you tomorrow.
Drive through McDonald's today and grab a totally loaded Daily Double. It's two beef patties with cheese, lettuce, tomato, mayo, and onions. And right now you can get it for just $1.89. The new Daily Double, part of the all-new Extra Value menu. So grab the Daily Double for $1.89 today. Now that's tasty value. McDonald's, I'm loving it.
Mike Rowe here at a Ford dealer with a little Q&A for Fiona. According to the signs, Ford is having some sort of a big tire event. How would you describe the event?
It's big.
The savings one might enjoy at the event.
They're big.
What about the selection?
Big.
Click the banner ad for a $100 rebate offer on four select name brand tires.
So I think we can agree then that Ford's tire event is good sized.
No, Michael. It's big.
Fiona, I'm going to take your word for it.
Offer cannot be combined. Stop by any participating Ford dealer or visit FordOwner.com for rebate details through 531-12.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Hi, thank you very much, and welcome back. And we're joined in the studio by singer-songwriter David Rovics. You can go to his website, David Rovics, ROVICS.com. A lot of great downloadable music, and once in a while people even buy stuff there, don't they?
Occasionally.
And David has just come back from a tour of Europe, and he and Jolene were at the anti-NATO protests in Chicago. But I want to get him to sing a couple songs, too, but we have some people waiting and relevant to the subject about NATO. Let's see if they're in line with what we're saying or whether they feel another way. Here is Andrew and Taylor. Andrew, hi. It's Peter and Jolene and David Rovics. Hi. You're on the air.
Hey, what's up?
Doing the show, man. What's up with you?
Just want to talk about NATO, I guess.
Go ahead.
Well, I kind of have to disagree with you a little bit about the necessity of NATO. I think the military spending is a bit, you know, overdue, like, or not overdue, but a bit over the top.
A bit?
Yeah, it is.
A bit.
Just a bit, you know.
You're in the majority, too. Most people agree with that. But go ahead. What do you think the value of NATO is?
Well, the need of it isn't as much as it used to be back in the Cold War, but Russia is still a bit of a uneasy nation with this whole turn of power, or not turn of power, but with this guy staying in power with Vladimir Putin. I mean, he's kind of known for this whole ballot shoving thing, you know.
Yeah, he's pretty bad guy. Anybody, yeah. God, who steal an election and stuff. Oh, that's Bush, isn't it? But wait. What about the idea, though, that we have an alliance that is allied against them, and we're putting these missile defense things right on their border? I mean, what do you think if they had a South Atlantic Treaty Organization, and they had Venezuela, Nicaragua, and you know, Peru, places like that, and part of their military alliance, and they were building missile defense systems in Mexico? How do you think we'd feel?
I would probably be pretty pissed off.
Yeah. So what does that do to your argument?
Well, I was going to say, like, you know, I think they're trying to go with that whole old political theory of, like, speak soft and carry a big stick. But I think they're being a bit instigative about it with the Russian border. Like I was, you know, saying that Russia's a bit uneasy, not to mention Greece with all the elections they just had.
How is Russia uneasy, and what threat have they?
Yeah, they don't, you know, they never really did. That whole stuff with the Soviet Union being a threat to the United States, they found out that they never had any plans. The United States actually had plans to, had contingency plans to invade and occupy the Soviet Union. But the Soviet Union, I mean, they were terrified of the United States. They thought we were absolutely crazy. And
Wait a minute.
What?
We are.
Yeah, and Henry Kissinger, that was part of his theory of what he called the real politic, and that is to make your opponent think you are capable of anything. And the real problem was, I think a lot of those people were. All right, Andrew, thank you very much.
David, thoughts?
Oh, I agree entirely.
All right. Let's talk to Dave in Livonia. Dave, hey, it's Peter and Jolene. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I mean, you guys just touched on the point I wanted to make just a little bit. But
what's that?
You know, I can understand why the Russians would be a little pissed off. I mean, I know, you know, we live in a different time, and it's a different, you know, world scope and whatever, but does anybody remember a little thing called the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yeah, I was just watching the X-Men, which that's the setting of it. It was pretty scary. You know, I knew somebody that used to say, you know, people that were lived through that era and the assassination of Kennedy. People would say, you know, I remember exactly where I was when John F. Kennedy, mm-hmm. and they said, was killed. But wait a minute, let me finish. But then I heard one guy say, I remember exactly where I was when John F. Kennedy tried to kill me, meaning his, you know, insane reaction to the, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Because you remember what that was all about. The United States, and that is even in the X-Men, that the United States had put nuclear missiles in Turkey, had ringed the Soviet Union with nuclear missiles, and old Khrushchev was just trying to kind of get a little parody there, and no way was the U.S. going to allow that. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Now, I guess the last point I wanted to make, you know, which is kind of solidifying this whole thing, is, I mean, you know, what you guys just said with the last caller is, you know, how would we feel if they set something up in our backyard? You know, we'd be pretty pissed off too.
Yeah, yeah, and you know what? Okay, thank you very much. And they think, you know, we're pretty belligerent. They're frightened of the West. They always have been. I mean, the West has invaded them three times since the beginning of the 19th century, and killed tens of millions. Western nations have killed. Well, it was mostly just, you know, France and Germany, but tens of millions of Russians. I'd like to get David Rovix to sing a song, but maybe we can get into this. Just I was going to say, man, I just am not going to – I don't want to talk about the elections for the next 5 months, you know?
Peter.
What?
Bite your tongue.
Why?
We have to talk about it.
Well, I certainly the song – in fact, we played this song, the recording of David Rovix singing this. I want to ask him to sing it. But did you see this thing, David, where this billionaire – what's his name here? Ricketts. Joe Ricketts. Yeah, who owns the Chicago Cubs and stuff like that. They were urging him to spend $10 million on these ads. And I don't even want to say what they were all about.
They're bringing up.
I don't want to even say what it's about.
They're bringing up old news.
Old
is what
stuff.
They're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, dirty old stuff.
And it's, you know, a group of high-profile Republican strategists working with this conservative billionaire. Oh, what a surprise, you know.
I mean, yeah, what a shock.
That's a little redundant, isn't it? Yeah. But the deal is, I was thinking that they may not even really ever thought that they were going to launch this because they have gotten the same PR out of it for free because everyone was denouncing. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, if you haven't seen this in the news, it was just some stupid ad. But one of the things they wanted to get was an extremely literate conservative American, and it's some jerk-off talk show host in L.A. I was actually on television with him once arguing.
Is it Neil?
No. Yeah, this is an African-American guy. Anyways, they said their spokesman would say that Mr. Obama misled the nation by presenting himself as what the proposal calls, you ready for this?
Yeah.
A metrosexual Black Abe Lincoln. These people
unbelievable.
They are so totally crazy.
Yeah.
And people take them seriously. These nuts were always here, but they were so far off on the fringe.
And, of course, they're calling the whole thing, it's titled The Defeat of Barack Hussein Obama.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They always.
Bring that back again, too.
Yeah, you're right. And where's Bill Ayers? Palling around with Bill Ayers. I've palled around with Bill Ayers.
You have.
My old pal, Bill. But hey, let's do this.
Have you palled around with Bill Ayers, David?
I still haven't met him, no.
Really? Well, no. You were in Chicago.
I was in Chicago, and I met Tom Morello, and I met what's his name, with the band Rise Against. And,
yeah.
Yeah. So I was Hank palling around with lots of celebrities today, but not Bill.
Well, one of the things that is thrown at Barack Obama all the time, that he's a socialist, that he's got this hidden agenda, that he's going to, you know, he's a red, and, and David Rovix has a song that speaks directly to that.
I do.
And it's called
If Only It Were True.
Yeah.
I turned on my TV, though it was hard to see these men who would be head of state. What a great country from sea to shining sea. We watched the Republicans debate. Newt stood with his third wife and said, you bet your life the president is a red.
He wants to tax the rich a lot. Take your limo and your yacht. He wants to have the bankers' heads. And if he gets in again, he'll paint the White House pink and then he'll hire Chavez as his VP. Then we'll be right on track to give capitalism the sack along with the insurance industry. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you? If only it were true, if only it were true, if only it were true. He'll give everyone food stamps and wheelchair ramps. He'll subsidize windmills and maple syrup. He'll cripple industries with eco-friendly policies. And pretty soon we will be just like Europe. He'll shut down oil wells, give out solar cells to every home in Delaware and Illinois. He'll ban logging in the parks. He'll send the works of Karl Marx to the homes of every American girl and boy. He'll abolish pesticides. He'll be giving out free rides and free lunches, too, in his high-speed trains. He'll start lots of public works full of union perks. He'll fill all the cities up with bicycle lanes. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you? If only it were true, if only it were true, if only it were true. Watch out, his critics tell. This shall be our death knell. He'll pull the troops out and end all of our wars. He'll gut military spending. Our empire will be ending, and soon we'll be invaded by the Moors. He'll legalize all drugs, give away beer mugs and hookahs to every child and Korans. He'll ban religions from the schools, give 40 acres and a mule to every person who makes less than 50 grand. He'll close Guantanamo to torture. He'll say no. He'll make us all drive electric cars. He'll reinstate the fairness doctrine, take off that damn flag pin, and he'll put Rupert Murdoch behind bars. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you? If only it were true, if only it were true, if only it were true. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you? If only it were true, if only it were true, if only it were true.
Yeah. David Rovics on the Night Call Show. You can go to davidrovics.com, download that song, lots of others.
And you know what I say to those people who called us Obama apologists?
Yeah.
If we were, we wouldn't allow that song on our show.
Absolutely. So all you conservatives are safe, right? David Rovics, you just came back. Well, you toured the United States. You played here in Detroit. And then, in fact, you went, what, right from here to Ireland, if I remember.
Yeah, right? I didn't really tour the U.S. I had one gig in Detroit on the way and then three gigs in the Midwest on the way back. But basically, I've been in Europe for the whole spring, two and a half months.
I'm always, everybody from, actually, musicians, American musicians being successful in every genre is not unusual. But with your topical songs and in the countries you were in, like you were in Norway, right, as well?
I was in nine countries. Wow. Norway, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Germany, Switzerland, Belgium, Holland, Britain, Ireland.
Only a couple of them speak English. So what happens
those are all English-speaking countries. Yeah.
Tell us.
They are. Those are all countries where Scandinavia, Holland, Flanders, which is the Flemish-speaking part of Belgium, and Britain and Ireland, of course, everybody's fluent in English in all those countries. And in Germany, it's like 50-50. But there's 80 million Germans, so you got 40 million who speak fluent English, so that's a lot of them.
So people understand you.
Half of them do.
Yeah. Yeah. And the rest of this thing is good. It sounds nice.
The other half don't come to my shows. Yeah. You know,
in Germany. How do they know about you? I mean, what would make them, I look forward to David Rovics show in Detroit. I know, like I said, you're a troubadour, you're a great musician and guitar player. And, but how in the world do they know that? I mean, I would think you'd wind up with four people.
It's a different story. No, I have better crowds in Europe than I do in the U.S., and it's a different story in each country how they know about me. Each country has a different, a different story how it happened. I mean, lately, a lot of the people coming to my shows in Germany are, for example, are members of the Pirate Party, Piraten, who have just gotten elected to a number of different state legislatures, and they're on their way to the national legislature in Germany, and they use one of my songs as their theme song.
Which one?
Black Flag Flying, which is about the golden age of piracy. So that's been, so I had other fans in Germany before, but now many of them are pirates, and there's many new fans.
And for people who are listening, we don't mean pirates out on the seas.
They call themselves pirates.
He's got a good Somali pirate song too.
Yeah, you do. But explain that a little more, maybe. Dave.
In the German pirates.
Well, the German pirates. Where they come out of originally is the music pirate movement. The sort of copyleft. The kind of idea that intellectual property law is all messed up. That's kind of where they're coming from. And transparency in government and a whole different idea of intellectual property. And then, of course, then once they get elected to government and they have to decide on what their opinions are about other issues, then they're having to sort of trial by fire kind of come up with a position on a lot of other issues that they didn't, really think much about until they got in.
Well, David Rovick, I've been introducing you continually because people, come in and out of radio shows as singer-songwriter. I could have added the adjective also radical, but usually governments don't like radicals coming into their country. Do you have any problems traveling through Europe? They say, well, wait a minute, we don't want this guy singing these rad songs in our country.
Check out your CDs. Well, there are no border crossings, though, right?
Yeah, once you're in Europe, you're in what's called the Schengen zone, then the area that there's no borders, then it's just like going from one state to another in the U.S. But getting into Europe is also extremely easy because, there's a lot of stories about Europeans and others trying to tour in the U.S. and getting turned away because they don't have. And this happens sometimes in England as well. But like continental Europe, they never ask me what I'm doing there. I mean, they never talk to me. They just look at the American passport and stamp it, and that's it. That's the whole process. Occasionally in Germany, if I'm landing in Germany, they'll say, "Welcome to Germany." And that's about about it. In Denmark, they don't even grunt. They just look at the passport, stamp it, and that's it, But in England and Ireland, they'll ask you, what are you doing here? Yeah. And then you tell them whatever you want to tell them, and then they say, okay, that's nice. And then they stamp your passport.
So it's not, you're working in Europe, though, essentially.
I'm working.
So that's not a problem for them?
Well, I don't tell them that, but it is. It would be.
What did we just do?
If I told them, it could be a problem. Yeah. I mean, because technically, I don't have a work visa.
He's so transparent.
There.
Should I hit the delay button?
No.
Just call immigration now. Thing is, they don't seem to have computers most of the time. So even if we called them and told them, watch out for this guy. He's going to come back and do a concert tour. Doesn't matter because they're just not going to look me up in the first place.
But Canada's another story. You've had a couple of issues with that. Not as of late, though, right?
I was banned from Canada for a year.
What was the deal with that again?
Trying to play a gig without a work permit. And then they discovered that I was playing a gig without the work permit. Yeah.
A whole year?
A year.
Seems rather harsh to me. Couldn't there be a fine?
Or couldn't you have just had to stand in a corner for 20 minutes?
Yeah, right. That would be much more appropriate. Well, they looked at my record, and they saw that I had been banned from Canada for 8 days before, and another time I had been given 48 hours to leave the country. And so, they could see I've had all sorts of problems.
And you were just there in and out of Canada 3.5 months ago, but everything's okay. Everything's kosher now.
Well, every time I go, it takes an hour or two to go through the process of convincing them to let me into the country. But lately, I've had good luck with that.
I wouldn't do Windsor.
I got into Windsor. Okay.
Well, that's good. Hey, also, this last year, 2011, and into the first part of this year, there was all these Occupy sites. This was, everything from Occupy to Wall Street, of course, but around this country and other sites. And how many Occupy sites did you travel to and sing at?
I sang at about 30 of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Amazing.
Because last time I talked, I think it was about 19 or something.
But that was before I got to the West Coast.
Yeah. And what do you think, you know, like I know here in Detroit, it's Occupy Detroit has left its outdoor site and has a building and has kind of become a permanent site of resistance and renewal. What do you see elsewhere?
Well, I've been in Europe for the whole spring, and so I don't feel like I have a good sense of what's happening with the Occupy movement in the U.S. Right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if it's building up or fizzling out or what, you know, compared to the last time. I mean, certainly over the winter, it seemed to be largely kind of laying low, you know, compared to the fall. And a lot of people were hoping that when things warmed up, it would start picking up again. And I hope that's happening. But I certainly from paying attention to the international media, you would have no idea that there is anything happening with Occupy here, but
what about
I get
Europe?
The impression there is, you know, including Europe. I mean, you don't hear about it in the European media either. But in terms of Occupy movement in Europe,
yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, of course, after the Arab uprisings began, basically the first people that tried to follow the model of like taking space in the middle of the city and holding on to it until your demands are met, the sort of Tahrir Square model,
mm-hmm.
The first countries that that adopted the Cairo-Tunis kind of model were Greece and Spain, and there it was called the Indignados, the indignant ones, and they, you know, that's essentially in every way the Occupy movement of Greece and Spain. I mean, it's very much the same elements, people who had never been involved with political activism before, and also people who were very much inspired by the model presented by the Arab uprisings. You know, that represents a lot of the people in the indignants.
Well, the people there seem to realize that their future is at stake, and I don't think people get it here yet. Yeah, I mean, there was
fully. They don't
fully.
Get it.
Yeah, I mean, or there's this sense that that, you know, the old can't fight City Hall, where people did. I mean, in the Occupy site removals, the police arrested over 7,000 people. I mean, this last fall and this winter, and it was, you know, we were horrified by some of these pepper gas or pepper spraying.
Lieutenant Pike.
Yeah, old Lieutenant Pike out in Davis, California. But one of the things that was really ominous was that in a couple of places that the police showed up with assault rifles.
Wow.
And they weren't used, but in Denver and in Davis, I mean, you just saw that guy pepper spraying all those students sitting on the ground.
Yeah.
But there in the background, they had like perimeter squads with raised rifles. Again, you know, you can tell these 19-year-olds in their flip-flops and shorts, you know.
And what was the crime again? Wait, I think they were sitting on a
sidewalk.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what we should do? Yeah. We should take a commercial.
Yes.
We should do some commercials, take a break. And we'll be right back. I'd like to hear from you if you'd like to call us. So
questions for David.
Yeah.
313-298-9744.
Or I'd like to make a comment. We're also talking, in case you're joining us late, David Rovics, our guest, and Jillian Jordan, our co-host here, were just in Chicago at these anti-NATO protests. And we're going to talk a little, too, when we get back, I mean, what this all costs us. So right back after these.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jillian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jillian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com.
Ladies, want your breasts to look fuller in that new outfit, or do you want to look hot on the beach? I'm here with Dr. Michael Gray of the Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa. Dr. Gray, what are some of the different breast procedures I can have done?
Most people are aware of enlarging the breast. We can reduce the breast. We can lift the breast. Anything you can think of, that's what I can do.
Well, Dr. Gray, not all women want the same thing or have the same body type, so each woman should have their own unique consultation, shouldn't she?
What we do is we sit down, I examine you, and we make decisions. Now, in order to make a decision, you have to know what your options are and what the choices are. And then you'll tell me what it is you want me to do for you.
So to you, a person's body is like a work of art.
Exactly. I'm an artist. You can come to me and have anything done you want to know that you're going to be safe, I'm going to take care of you, and you'll get a great result.
Sounds fantastic. That's Dr. Michael Gray of the Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa. Call for a complimentary consultation at 248-538-3333. That's 248-538-3333. or visit anewyou.com.
I'm Dr. Michael Gray. Call me today, and I'll see you tomorrow.
What's your favorite restaurant? Is it a luxurious Italian bistro, a hip dessert place, or maybe your favorite local barbecue joint? YP Local Search wants to know. Click the banner in your media player or visit the YP Facebook page to enter the My Favorite Restaurants contest, brought to you by YP Local Search. Simply share with us your favorite restaurant, and you could win a Visa gift card valued at $4,999 to use any way you like. That's a lot of great meals. Compliments of YP Local Search. Must be 18 to enter. See contest rules on website for details. Void where prohibited.
Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
With the sound of salesmen. geared up for Memorial Day weekend in the manliest way possible with Coke Zero and 101 The Riff. Listen to score your very own WRIF men card, along with a Coke Zero Battleship prize pack. One lucky Riff winner will win the grand prize, a trip for two to sunny San Diego, take a tour of the Midway Museum, and have a private dinner at the home of the Navy's top guns. You can also use the code inside Coke Zero packages to join in the battle for everything.com.
No purchase necessary. Game ends Friday, May 25th. Residency and other restrictions apply. See rules at WRAF.com. A battleship rated PG-13 may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Listen and win from Coke Zero and 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Motor City. Welcome, Juliet, your 2012 Riff Rock Girl. Check out all her details and some great pics from the finals party online at WRIF.com.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan in the WRIF studios, along with David Rovics, who is a singer-songwriter. You can go to davidrovics.com, and also soundclick.com/davidrovics as well. We're going to play something from...
soundclick.com.
What did I say?
/davidrovics. You just left out the .com. It's all right, it's all right.
Yeah. If you want to call us, 313-298-WRIF, which is...
313-298-9743.
Yeah. Have you been posting anything on Facebook during the show?
No.
But we still would like you to like us. So it's facebook.com/nightcall. In about 12 hours, we'll have a podcast up. Athena and Sarah are, can't say manning the phones. What do you say?
But they're personing the phones.
Personing the phones. But there was something. Oh, yeah. I want to do this one little thing, though, before we do anything else. I want to try to remember. Can't do that. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. A couple of guests in an hour. Suzanne Gordon. Oh, man. This is not. I say this every week, right?
Don't say it again.
That it's going to sound boring, but it's not.
How do you do this every
yeah, all
week?
Right. Anyways, a couple of very interesting guests, mostly about health and health care. And if they weren't interesting, I wouldn't put them on the air. No doubt. Right. Okay, well, we want to get David to sing another song, but I just wanted to say a couple of things. There's, I was going to talk about the military budget, but we'll do that in a minute. There, you know, these Republicans are so, I mean, they almost make you love the Democrats. Republican Joe Pitts, a Pennsylvania Republican who's up for re-election, he served on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. So now you would think these guys, he would know what he's talking about, right? But a constituent wrote him a letter suggesting that, you know, they got to find some peace in the Middle East. And here's what Republican Representative Joe Pitts wrote back. With the global war against terrorism, it is now incumbent upon Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Palestinian Authority Chairman Yasser Arafat to clamp down on Palestinian extremists that have perpetuated violence and to restart a peace process that has collapsed. Little problem here, Joe Pitts. Arafat died in 2004, and Ariel Sharon has been in a coma since 2006. One observer noted it would be like negotiations between a vegetable and a dead man.
Oh, my God. I thought you were mistakenly reading an old account.
No. No. I mean, these guys are, you know, the clue bus has left, and they are not on it. Here's another thing, and this is just more outrage, of course. Arizona's Secretary of State said Friday he had asked officials in Hawaii to verify that Barack Obama was born in their state in order for the president's name to appear in the November ballot in Arizona. I mean, this is outrageous in itself, but get this. Ken Bennett, who is the Republican presidential candidate, Mitt Romney's campaign co-chair in Arizona, said he made the request on behalf of a constituent. Now, you ready for this? He is the chair of the Mitt Romney campaign in Arizona, and he's also the Secretary of State that oversees voting.
How does this happen? Repeatedly.
I think it's called a racket.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. I got to actually do something here that...
You know what? Apparently, we got an email from Jerry. Thanks for writing, Jerry. There was a hit and run. Someone was hit by a police van. I didn't see that one.
In Chicago. Where you guys were for the anti-NATO protests.
And Rahm Emanuel's lackey says, this is from Jerry, claims a person slashed tires on the van and ran away. I don't know.
And then he got hit by it?
Yeah.
I thought the guy was in a wheelchair. I guess you can slash tires if you're in a wheelchair.
An ambulance came to take someone away in a wheelchair. That's what CNN says. I don't know. Have to look into it.
All right. You may or may not remember, I mean, this stuff goes out of our mind so quickly, that there was a young soldier named Bradley Manning, and he released some damaging information about the activity of the United States around the world, or at least this is what he's accused of, let me say. And a lot of this was picked up by WikiLeaks. Far as I know, no one is, contrary to what all the American officials have said, it's mostly just embarrassed them, and no one's ever been hurt because of this. That's right, David? Yeah.
Yeah, there's no evidence of anybody being hurt because of these disclosures.
Well, except for Bradley Manning.
Well, I mean, except for Bradley Manning. Yeah, but in terms of the embassy cables, I mean, there's none of these supposedly endangered people have been actually hurt. There's just been, a lot of making the U.S. government look really bad because it exposes their actual inner workings and what people actually say to each other, which is really not pretty at all.
Now, you guys were at a Bradley Manning demonstration.
Well, it was an event.
In fact, do this. So.
Oh, wait. And the demo. But this weekend.
This court trial.
Set this up a little better. Tell us, I mean, the story is in your song, Song for Bradley Manning. But set this up a little so in case people aren't familiar with it.
Well, Bradley Manning was a soldier working as an intelligence analyst in Baghdad. And at the age of, I guess, 22 at the time, he realized that he was constantly dealing with information that that demonstrated that the U.S. was committing war crimes in Iraq. And armed with this knowledge, he felt like he had to do something to expose these crimes. And so he allegedly stole $500,000 files from the computers
and a Madonna CD
and stuff on a Lady Gaga CD.
Lady Gaga, yeah.
And released it all to WikiLeaks.
Yeah, and the rest is literally hysteria.
Held in solitary confinement for a very long time.
Yeah.
Forced to be...
Over a year, I think, and now he's forced to sleep naked, being woken up every half an hour, forced to sleep with this really scratchy wool blanket and just
fluorescent lights.
Yeah, fluorescent lights all night. I mean, they really were torturing him. Sleep deprivation is very much a form of torture, and so is so many of the other things, solitary and everything else. I mean, they were really trying to break him.
There was an international campaign. Not just to free him, but to protesting against the conditions that, where was he at, Camp Lejeune, wasn't he?
Quantico. Thank you, Quantico.
Yeah, and, there was this international outcry at the conditions he was being held under.
Which made a huge difference, which is why he was moved and why it got attention, right?
He was moved and now he's in a slightly better situation, I think. I don't know how great it is.
I always wondered, how you put all these songs together. They're topical, and Jolene was giving me an idea of how you did it.
I witnessed the process.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Something sparks, and it's any songwriter. There's a lot of musicians who listen to us, knows that it comes to you, and it came to him. He writes while he drives. drives.
What seems to me to be tough, and I was, Jolene and I were talking about your songs and how, if you're just doing Ooh Baby Ooh, if you have a great song, you don't need any more than really Ooh Baby Ooh. But if you're trying to tell a story, you not only have to, in a little short time with fairly short lines, have to tell sometimes complex stories like this one. And I pointed out to her but this took a long time, was Hurricane by Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Which is just an amazing song and reminds me of a lot of the stuff that you do.
Yeah.
And this just, it just comes to you, huh? I mean, because they rhyme. That's the other thing, too.
Oh, well, there's an art to rhyming, right?
They have to rhyme, yeah, and the rhymes have to appear effortless. I mean, you have to say exactly what you are trying to say, and it has to rhyme. And but yeah, you can't, you know, you can't force rhymes. You have to come up with real good ones that actually say what you're trying to say. But you know, beyond that, it's about, well, when you're trying to tell a story, first for me, and I think for a lot of songwriters, it's first the hook that you come up with, the thing that holds the whole song together, which is usually some part of the chorus, or you know, and then the rest of it comes a lot easier. But if you're trying to tell a fairly complex story, then you have to assign a subject for each verse. I mean, each verse has to accomplish something, and before it's done, and that's kind of.
Well, when Jalene, in describing the story, made it sound like, sounds like a very thoughtful process, whereas the way Jalene was describing it, it almost seemed spontaneous. Is there which is it, or both?
It's a little of both, because, yeah. I mean, you know, you have to be going somewhere with each of these verses, but I don't necessarily know in advance exactly where I'm going to go with that verse, like what it's going to say by the end of it, you know. It's
but the spark is spontaneous. That's spark, what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's I mean, when I heard that you know, when the news was out that they had that the authorities in Chicago had arrested three people on terrorism charges for you know, working with two undercover cops to make four Molotov cocktails, which is, you know, hardly even warrants being called an explosive in the first place. But in any case, you know, when I heard about that, I thought, well, this is a fabulous contrast between these supposedly terroristic Molotov throwers and the people actually running NATO and having these meetings, who in fact are not just traveling from Florida to Chicago to go to a protest to ostensibly throw several Molotovs, but they're flying from the U.S. to Afghanistan to completely demolish a country and kill, you know, thousands upon thousands of innocent civilians, which, well, it's not terrorism, of course, because it's the U.S. doing it, and so it can't
be terrorism. Well, if you kill civilians and you have a uniform on, you're military.
It's collateral damage.
If you don't, you're a terrorist.
Yeah.
You kill civilians, you know, you're...
That's the difference.
Yeah. You know, are they born often out of, and I mean, I guess the answer has to be yes, genuine outrage? I mean, I feel it in the songs. I mean, it's not...
Oh, yeah.
It's not like, oh, boy, this is great. Something awful happened. I can write another cool song. You know, no.
Yeah,
I mean,
But when you spend your time in this kind of realm where you're constantly reading and thinking about politics, and you're constantly kind of, you know, pissed off or constantly a bit flabbergasted at the idiocy of these people in power, then, you know, I guess I'm not as angry as the songs might come off, because I mean, if I were really embracing that feeling of anger all the time, then, you know, I'd be miserable. But you know, it's just sort of always in the background. I mean, it's always this constant knowledge that I'm living in a country that is run by war criminals who are constantly committing war crimes, you know, on people around the world and their own population as well. But that's so I'm tapping into that anger without necessarily you know, going around feeling angry all the time.
Well,
there are a lot of people who are activists who are angry all the time. I sat down next to this guy. I said, "Hey, how are you today?" And he goes, "I'm finding it very hard to smile these days." Mm. I just felt really bad for him.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Well, I know that on some of your albums, and I'm talking with David Rovics, singer-songwriter. You go to David Rovics, ROVICS.com, or we're going to play something from SoundClick. .com/DavidRovics is that sometimes I listen to your music and it a couple times, I mean, this how successful they've made me so sad, I think, I don't know if I can keep listening. And then suddenly there'll be a song about love or a song about children or something like that kind of pulls it out, you know. And
yeah, you can't just do depressing songs about depressing subjects one after the other. You have to break it up with inspiring songs.
Well, we're going to have to love. And, yeah, we're going to have to get you to do an upbeat song after this one because this is a song for Bradley Manning. You're listening to Night Call on WRIF, and this is David Rovix. Now let's see if this will do it. Oh, there we go. Listen to Night Call on WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. Jillian Jordan is with me, as always. And in the studio, David Rovix. And that was one of his songs. Song for Bradley Manning. Here's what who we call Ron Paul Rick. He said, Ron Paul said, I'd have him protected under the Whistleblowers Act. Ron Paul says he'd protect Bradley Manning and other whistleblowers. Ron Paul is anti-NATO, and you guys can't support Ron Paul.
Do we have to say it again?
Yeah.
How many times do we have to say that there are a lot of good things about Ron Paul, Rick, but there are a lot of horrific things as well? So, sorry, never going there. What do you have to say about that?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I agree. I mean, it's great that he's consistently libertarian rather than the sort of run-of-the-mill Republicans who preach libertarianism while supporting empire and big government in
big
actuality.
Corporations, yeah,
yeah, massive corporations. But of course, I mean, Ron Paul not only, well, I mean, of course, he supports big corporations by virtue of not wanting to regulate them.
Yeah.
If you don't regulate them, they don't go away. They just get bigger and more aggressive. And, you know, it doesn't work. It's a total fantasy.
Well, what I don't understand, what I think I've said every time Rick writes into us, he's actually called once.
Which is every week.
Yeah.
And I met him in person.
Yeah.
Such a nice guy.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he is. Maybe, did I meet him?
No.
No.
You didn't.
I think I did. Oh, yeah, we did. Actually, I think he was down at the first Occupy Detroit Act.
Oh, wait a minute.
Back in October,
yeah,
or whenever.
He came to one of my remotes.
That was, yeah. I don't know about you, but I'm going to vote for the lesser of the two evils.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of Mitt Romney and that gang, that worst gang, you know, like I always say, you know, Obama's better than a stick in the eye, and the Republicans are a stick in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could understand people saying, look, they are so much the same, I'm staying home. What I can understand is anybody making less than $400,000 voting for Mitt Romney. You know that, but
yeah.
Wait. Well, let me just say that about Ron Paul. Wonder what we would do if it was Ron Paul versus Barack Obama, because you know that on a lot of social issues, Barack Obama isn't too bad. It probably would be better if he had more of an opportunity. You know.
Not going to do it.
Yeah. On the other hand, Ron Paul is much better on civil liberties, on issues of war.
Yeah.
You know, overseas. Yeah. On all the drug laws, everything like that. You know, Barack Obama was at a meeting in somewhere in Latin America. He says, we're not changing the drug laws. So,
right. Didn't
yeah.
he recently do some beefing up as well?
They probably all are. You know, it's, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's another, that's one of the, you know, the complexes where all are rat holes. I mean, just this deal in Honduras that just occurred there was DEA agents making raids in rural Honduras. Did you see this, David?
No, I didn't.
And killed a bunch of people. They didn't kill. They said that the U.S. People didn't shoot, but that there was DEA agents joined counter-narcotics efforts in Honduras. A commando-style squad of drug enforcement agents accompanied the Honduran counter-narcotics police during two firefights with cocaine smugglers in the jungles of Central America, Central American country this month. And a whole bunch of people were killed, including two pregnant women. And now they're saying, well, you know, they must have been on board this place where gunfire. Yeah, but what the hell is the DAA, any United States agency doing running around another country? And, I mean, do we really want to spend that money? Do we really want to put everyone, including the agents, in harm's way so people don't snort cocaine?
Right.
I mean, talk about being libertarian. I would rather have the money for our schools and our whatever else.
Infrastructure,
libraries, what have you, that are all getting ruined instead of sending money. So commando-style squads of DEA agents. Man, I don't get that. Okay, let's see. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Mike in Fenton. Mike, it's Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, and David Rovics. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, I kind of really like that music. It's sort of depressing if you get to thinking about it, though. But
well, yeah, but you need to, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
My thing is you know, I think we've really lost our country. You know, do you guys think we're ever going to get our country back? It seems like there's people running it. They're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. They're treating us just as bad as they're treating these people in other countries. They just haven't started shooting us yet. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if that starts happening.
Wait, well, wait.
Depends
on who's going to shoot us?
Oh, the government.
What? The government.
Oh, the government. Well, yeah. I'll tell you, the governments do what they have to do to stay in power. If they can kind of frighten people, or if they can get this culture of submission in, where people just, you know, are fearful of anybody in authority and don't dare to even question authority on any level, that's okay. And there's lots of ways to mystify people, a lot of ways to divert people's anger and frustration and fears and what have you, and direct it into scapegoats. So lots of ways. But at some point, you know, then they start pepper gassing you and, you know, clubbing you and stuff like that. Right. But if it really comes down, you know, remember how this country got started? Just a bunch of people said, hey, we don't want to be with you anymore. And what did Britain do? They sent in guys with guns. So but the only thing I would question, I don't know if this is where you were going to go, David, we lost our country. I think we had the sense we had our country maybe from like 1945 to 1975. That was the window in which our middle class really expanded, that we all had the sense that everybody was going to do, quote, better with every succeeding generation, that the opportunities for even the poor were open to elevate themselves. And then boom, I mean, it just went away. I mean, so.
Where were you going to go with it, David?
We have to redefine what our country is, or like I always say, or we should just thatch our roofs and admit we're peasants. I mean, that's sort of our options.
But, well, we stood up to them and they destroyed us, and there's nothing we can do. That, you know, we did try to do our part, but these guys are something else.
Yeah.
Well, if there's a mass movement that's well enough organized and sustained enough, then it can accomplish amazing things, and it has in the past in this country and in other countries all over the world in the very recent times. You know, mass movements can accomplish great things, but as long as people have the sense, which I think is a really pervasive feeling that people have all over the U.S. and actually all over the developed world, is the sense that everything is inevitably going to keep on getting worse and there's just nothing we can do about it. That's the overwhelming sense, that defeatist attitude that is sure to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. But people can change everything if they're well organized enough into mass movements. I think that's always that's always the answer.
And also the feeling that power is so entrenched. I mean, you're supposed to have a democracy. It's weird. People say, do we have a democracy? Do we have a democracy? We have the greatest country in the world. Do you think we can change policy? And then you could really talk to people, and they say that economic and political power is so entrenched and so impervious to political or to popular control or even pressure. So, I mean, that's sort of, conflicting view. Mike, thank you very much. Here, Dave from Detroit thinks, what's so horrific about Ron Paul? Is that your question, Dave?
Go for it.
Well, I think we already kind of went through the list. Did you not hear that?
I just called in.
Oh, okay.
All I heard it was about regulation. So, I mean, horrific is a pretty strong word. So I just wondered if what.
Really?
Well, how about.
Well,
how about this? That Ron Paul, being this libertarian, I mean, it is Reaganomics within the capitalist system that created the basis for this collapse. Ron Paul, like so many of his just conservative brethren, want less regulations on corporations rather than more. If you're going to have a capitalist system, I mean, these banksters and these corporate heads, I mean, if there wasn't regulation, they'd be having 12-year-olds working 14 hours a day again like they did. They would have no minimum wage. And it's very possible that Ron Paul is against the minimum wage. Eh?
Pretty sure.
Well, allow me to retort.
Go ahead.
Talking about this guy anymore? He's out of it.
No,
he's not out of it, actually.
Oh, come on.
Let him go. Go. Dave.
All over the states. I mean, I was just at the Republican convention in Detroit this past weekend. I was organizing for Wayne County. Now, we didn't do quite as well as some of these other states, but the mass media is not reporting on what is going on with the delegate counts. I mean, Romney is actually losing delegates right now, and the media does not know how to spin this. Now, I'm not saying he's going to win the thing, but I'm simply saying there is a movement going on. But I do want to answer your question directly. You talked about regulations. What Dr. Paul has always stated is, why don't we just enforce the fraud laws and the crime laws that we have right now? You want to create more regulations. They're not enforcing the ones we have. So
give us an example. Give me one example.
Sarbanes-Oxley. terrible, terrible policy. And I mean, you know, Enron basically happened because of it. So if you get rid of the regulation that causes these things and start enforcing the laws that we already have on the books against fraud, against crime, against, you know, one person against another or corporation against a human being, I mean, we wouldn't be dealing with this kind of garbage right now.
Well, how in the world would those things even be defined as crimes if there weren't regulations against them? I mean, we know what how corporations functioned in the, you know, like they still do, but like how they did since their origins and into the robber baron era in, you know, the 19th century and the way they fought unionization because they wanted to keep people working 12 and 14 hours a day and child labor and no safety standards and no vacations and no pensions and nothing. I mean, without regulations, without unions, that's the way we'd all be back in the 19th century.
Let me give you something practical.
Wait. Before you give me something practical.
Who's defining what's practical?
Give me that. Give me what, this, without regulating these corporations, that are able to control commerce. I mean, there's nothing like a free market because what happens, I mean, the tendency towards, of capitalism is always towards monopolization and they can control the market and they can control what they buy, including our labor.
Right, and I agree with that, but what you're criticizing is what Dr. Paul criticizes. That's crony capitalism. We've never experienced true free market capitalism in this country, ever.
Or Christianity, ever. Or communism, but you know what? I mean, if you start saying communism, people think what? Stalin is Russia, or, you know, Mao is China, or something like that. And this is capitalism. I mean, capitalism began as this terrible system that everyone, all the common people opposed, that was brought about by these rich princes and these, you know, emerging industrialists. The only way they could even keep it going, like in England, was to station tens of thousands of troops to keep the people from burning down the factories, for, you know, for instance.
Absolutely. Like I said, I think we agree on more than we disagree. I think just the terminology and what we're going after. You talked about the banksters. I would argue that Dr. Paul's been the toughest on the so-called banksters. I mean, nobody's talking about auditing the Federal Reserve to find out what the hell they're doing over there.
I agree,
you know,
on
what
that.
Banks they're bailing out.
Hey, you know, we said that there were some aspects of Ron Paul that I thought were interesting. Here's what I always thought. If the American people could have their political views represented on the left by Dennis Kucinich, who no longer is even in Congress, on the left, and Ron Paul on the right, we would get a real choice. But you know what? Give me one final sentence because I got to go to our commercials.
One final sentence. I think
there it is. See ya. No.
We're all individuals, and we need to treat each other as such and stop thinking in terms of collectivist groups because it just doesn't work.
Okay, I guess I don't agree with that. I think it's opposite is true, but that's where we disagree. Dave, thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right, we're going to be right back with me, Peter Werbe, Jalene Jordan, and David Rovitz.
You're listening to Nightfall with Peter Werbe and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. We're back with more Nightfall on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. You're joined in the studio by singer-songwriter David Rovitz. You can go to davidrovitz.com. And we've been playing, well, we're going to play another song as well, from soundclick.com/davidrovitz. And speaking of websites, you know, I am moving into the 21st century. You know how little I've mentioned my website recently?
Really?
It's Facebook. You got to check our Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. And we want likes. We'd like you to like us. Right. 313-298-WRIF. Want to play another of David Rovick's songs, but want to get Charlene from Commerce on. Charlene, hi. It's Peter and Jalene.
Hi.
And David, welcome.
Yes, thank you. David brings a great sense of hope because I do feel that changes can't be made because I've come under the realization about what consumer confidence really is.
What do you mean?
Well, if you think about a poor person, any money they get a hold of, guess what they do with it?
Spend it.
They spend it.
Yeah.
So So what consumer confidence is, it comes from the poor people. Consumer, so poor people are consumer confidence, and so they make capitalism possible.
Wow. Here we thought it was the rich.
No, nope, it's the poor that creates consumer confidence.
Losing.
And,
yeah.
Don't believe what we tell you.
Don't believe
what we tell
you. Funny. How many poor people does it take to screw in a light bulb?
Am I going to like this?
What?
Well, it takes all of them because they're the ones that created the economy, to have the factory with the light bulb and the electricity flowing and everything.
Oh.
They're the consumer confidence that provided the money.
Like the working person? Is that what we're getting at?
I thought it was going to be something about being screwed, but maybe not. All right, Charlene, thank you for that point.
Yeah.
I had something else in my brain, but here. Kathleen called. This is from Athena and Sarah in our phone screener room, saying she wanted to tell you guys she's very appreciative of the show, and you guys are intelligent and gives answers to a lot of questions of hers. Well, thank you, Kathleen. Say hello to Mom.
Yes.
No.
Or what?
That's the joke. It's like, you know.
Bad.
No,
that's not bad,
good.
Peter.
All right. Okay. David, are you with us, David? David's here.
All right.
Here's another song. As David said earlier, he had visited and sang at about 30 Occupy sites. Remember all that? Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Detroit. And these things slip from memory pretty quickly. And there's a lot of ways to retain memory. One of them is through songs. And there's at soundclick.com/DavidRovix. There is a photograph of you singing, and then there is a huge Declaration of Independence, or is it the Constitution, in back of you.
Yeah, that was at the at Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. last October. That was the stage.
And that is the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, a really, really big one.
It is big, I mean, because the letters are as big as you are.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's do this. This is, I don't want to make it like this is ancient history because a lot of the Occupy activities are still going on. Still challenging the, what is my t-shirt?
What does it say, Peter?
Occupy
99%.
It's like a football.
Yeah.
Hey, and a shout out to, I ran into a couple of Occupy Detroit people today.
Oh,
in Chicago.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, David Rovix, our guest, and Jolene Jordan, we're in Chicago for the anti-NATO protest. All right, let's play this song. It's called Occupy Wall Street, David Rovix, I think. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because this is where they buy the politicians. Because this is where power has its seat. Because 99% of us are suffering at the mercy of the madmen on this street. Because all of us are victims of class warfare being waged on us by the 1%. Because these greedy banksters rob the country, leaving us without the means to pay the rent. Because the last time that we had decent government was about 1932. Because we the people are supposed to run this country, but instead it's all run by and for the few. Because now we know the rich do not pay taxes, but when they need a hand, it's us who bail them out. Because we suspected we lived in a plutocracy, but suddenly of late there is no doubt. So we're gonna stay right here. Stay right here. Because both my parents lost their seeds. Because I have never opened an account. Because the interest on my credit card just doubled, and now I can't pay the minimum amount. Because these budget cuts are just immoral, but our schools are still crowded as they are. Because there are no buses where I live, but I can't afford to drive a car. Because so many of us don't have health insurance, the rest of us have it, but it sucks. because the rich are flying in their private jets while the rest of us are slogging through the muck. Because capitalism isn't working. This system has just failed to produce. Because the 1% are prospering while the rest of us just suffer their abuse. So we're gonna stay right here. We're gonna stay right here. Because it isn't demonstrated amply that the winners are the ones who stick around. Because this world should belong to everyone, not just the banksters who would smash it to the ground. Because we've noticed voting doesn't change things when the politicians are mostly millionaires. Because we're learning how to stand up like Tunisians, like they did in Tahrir Square. Every young man named Mohammed Bouazizi struck a match that lit up all here. And all around the world the spell was broken, and a movement for the future was in birth. Because there's only so much the rich can feed us before we figure out which side we're on. Because we've learned if we want our liberation, it will only come if we stay here till the rising of the dawn. So we're gonna stay right here. We're gonna stay right here. Because corporations are not people, and we can't just let them choose. Because if we leave our fate to them, then all of us will surely lose. Because the climate clock is ticking, and we can't just leave our world behind. Because corporate rule isn't working, and it's time for humans' hearts and minds. Because you can't take it with you, because the rich just do not care. Because it doesn't matter how much you make, but how much you can share. Because these moments don't come often, because we want truly to be free. Because we know what really matters, something called society. So we're gonna stay right here. We're gonna stay right here. We're gonna stay.
On WRIF, you can hear that song and download it. It's, can you download that at SoundClick? SoundClick,
yeah.
.com/David Rovics. Also at David's site, David Rovics, R-O-V-I-C-S. And I was, you know, actually, got a little, another little note here. Oftentimes when people write in and compliment me, I always jokingly say, yeah, and say hello to mom. You know, in other words, making like it's...
Oh, that it's so, your
like
mom.
Yeah, like it's a relative.
But okay. Kathleen called back and said the comment Peter made about saying hi to mom. Her mom is 85 and says if she was awake right now, she would so much appreciate a show like this.
Aw.
Well,
hi, Mom.
Kathleen, you can do this. Mom can listen to it on the computer in about 11 hours or so. It'll be up at my site, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. It'll be on our Facebook page, yeah. Facebook.com/nightcall.
And you can always get it here at WRIF.com/podcast.
And yep. You can also do what I do, and probably what the easiest thing is just go to iTunes and download it as a free podcast. It's right there. You can stick it onto your iPod or whatever.
Our show?
Yeah,
take it with you.
Your show is there.
Well,
yeah. Didn't you know that, Peter?
No, what do I know? What do I know? One of the things we were talking earlier, and I do repeat this because some of you come in and out of the show, that David and Jalene were in Chicago for the anti-NATO protests that happened over the weekend. And one of the things that was under consideration is the extraordinary and obscene amount of money that goes to the military-industrial complex here.
Which is how much of the, it's like 50%.
50% of our taxes.
Yeah. I mean, if you really added it up correctly, it's about $1 trillion a year.
Right.
That's, you know, way beyond, what do they say? It's about $800 billion. Now it's $200 billion between friends. Huh? But Stephen Cull, who is director of the Program for Public Consultation, he's did a study called Consulting the American People on National Defense Spending. Three-quarters of respondents favored cutting defense as a way to reduce the deficit, including two-thirds of Republicans and 90% of Democrats. But one of the things that people hear, remember in the 1980s, the military had this infamous $800 toilet seat. Well, today it has a $17,000 drip pan. And this powerful congressman who the local paper, the Lexington, Kentucky Herald Leader, calls the Prince of Pork, and pork for most of you realize that this is stuff that, you know, that congressmen get to go to their district. And the Army has bought a $6.5 million worth of this leak-proof drip pan in the last 3 years to catch transmission fluid on Black Hawk helicopters. And if you connect that up with an earlier story, this is what they're using on these raids into Honduras with the, you know, the Drug Enforcement Agency. There's another company that makes a pan, $2,500, but they.
But you got to go for the big one, right?
Yeah. Okay, let's get Garrett in Ann Arbor. Garrett, hi, it's Peter and Jalene and David. You're on WRIF. Welcome. Hey, buddy.
Thanks.
Yeah, good.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Hey, me and my buddy are here listening. We've just been listening for the last maybe 5 minutes. And I think we should talk a little bit about some of the Reagan policies that were working well.
That were working well?
You don't think?
Go ahead.
Name two.
Yeah.
Which party do you consider yourself most affiliated with?
What?
Which party?
The party.
The People's Party. We're independents.
Yeah, we don't support. Reagan economics, what they call Reaganomics, is essentially what has destroyed the economy of the United States. So he winds up, besides being one of the most corrupt administrations.
One of the worst presidents ever.
Yeah, with having, I forgot how many people, 125 people indicted for crimes, although this administration should beat their record. But anyway, what could you possibly see good about the Reagan administration? The guy was a horrible president.
Well, I think that it taught us a good lesson about who not to elect.
oh God! Did we get suckered?
No. So yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, we shouldn't.
I don't get it.
No. Well, hopefully he means that a guy that you know talks I don't know about mourning in America and I don't know and just is all. You know, all face and, you know, just selling out the country to the big interests to an electum. That's what I got out of it.
All right.
Okay, Garrett, try listening for a little more in 5 minutes.
Yeah, it would be useful.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Guess what? We're almost done. We should just kind of wrap
David,
up.
David, do you have any thoughts on Reagan?
Final thoughts. Yeah. I mean, actually, it was I was reading, working on a song recently. I was researching the what was done to the to media law in this country under Reagan, and actually how so much of the damage that Reagan started, Bill Clinton actually finished mm-hmm. in a much, much more extensive way.
Like Telecommunications
I mean,
Act.
Yeah, like the, under Reagan, they deregulated owning multiple radio stations so you could have up to, I can't remember how many, but then under Clinton, they just got rid of the thing altogether.
Wide
so
open,
that,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're one of these cool corporations here. Greater Media, great company to work for, and they're not one of those.
No, yeah, not one of those we shall not mention, or maybe you want to mention them.
We won't, no.
And we're willing to kiss a little ass on here.
Doesn't hurt.
I'm trying to look on my site for all the stuff about Reagan. I don't know. It comes and goes.
Well, go to peterwerby.com.
Also, bank deregulation. I mean, he started this bank deregulation, which then was continued in a big way under Clinton once again. I mean,
Clinton was a good Republican.
He was a
great
Republican, yeah. And yet he's, you know, as someone who goes to Europe a lot, I have to say that he is still loved over
He's a superstar, isn't he?
He's still a superstar. He is still a sexy superstar.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I've met him before, and there's something about that man's presence that I can understand why people do that. Unless they know anything.
He's tall.
He's tall.
He used to be big.
Well, I know a woman who,
I know it.
Wait,
yeah. This is a family show.
This is a family. Yeah, she was working for an NGO. She's from Yugoslavia, and she met Bill Clinton one time, and he knew everything about her before approaching her. And this was true of 100 other people in that room. She said he had a just unbelievable memory for who all these people were, what they were doing there, and you know, I mean, they. You would think that if somebody rises to that kind of position of power, that they would be good at something. I mean, so, you know.
Well, how do you figure Bush or Reagan? Reagan, who knew nothing about nothing, really. I mean, in terms of policy. Yeah. I mean, that's usually.
That's a whole other hour,
yeah.
Peter.
The Bush dad, he did. I mean, you know, he knew stuff. But, I mean, certainly Bush. You know, and Bush has, like, disappeared, right? Because they told him.
Well, he made an appearance last week.
He did. In an elevator, they said, who are you from? Who are you for? And he said, well, I'm for Romney, you know, like that. But they just want to keep him out of sight.
Yeah, I would, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, David Rovics, I want to thank you so much. I know you've had a long, long, long day. So,
fine day.
Yeah,
fine day.
But in Chicago, playing in Detroit, on Dearborn for this Palestinian event as well.
And then this show.
Yeah.
Most importantly.
So I think we're going to go home and go to sleep.
David.
But a couple of things remain. I'm going to have an hour of recorded interviews that I did about our health and what's happening with it, and then at 2 a.m., Ms. Lynn
will be here.
Yeah, to play the rock and roll. And although we didn't work Athena and Sarah very hard because we did all the yakking mostly today, we want to thank them greatly for doing the phones.
So much.
And we may not. I don't think we're going to be on next week because it's the holiday. I would say we're not. So we will see in a couple of weeks. David Rovics, keep playing. I know
Thank
I don't
got
to tell you that. And it's David Rovics, ROVICS.com. All right, so we'll talk in a couple weeks.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
In the name of
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
I give you
everything that rocks.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. There's a lot in the news about the Affordable Care Act, sometimes called Obamacare. Mitt Romney says one of the first things he'll do, if not the first thing, will be to repeal that act that extends health care. There's a book that's come to my attention that addresses this from a supportive side of the Affordable Care Act. It's called Fighting for Our Health, The Epic Battle to Make Health Care a Right in the United States. It's written by Richard Kirsch. He's an institute fellow at the Rockefeller Institute of Government. It focuses on federal and state implementation of health reform. And he's also a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He served as the National Campaign Manager for Healthcare for America Now between 2008 and 2010. He's been on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, CNN, ABC's World News Tonight, lots of different programs talking about this, and also the Colbert Report. We'll certainly talk with him about that. And from 1985 to 2008, he served as the executive director of Citizen Action of New York, which was a grassroots citizens organization with 20,000 members and 7 offices in New York. But there's great resistance to federal mandated health care, and we're going to talk about that. Let's welcome Richard Kirsch. He's in his office near Albany, New York. Richard Kirsch, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
It's great to be with you today, Peter.
Hey, let's begin maybe with the subtitle. That's been my favorite way to approach things. Your book, Fighting for Our Health, The Epic Battle to Make Healthcare a Right in the United States. Some critics say rights are just restricted to the Constitution. Most of those rights are non-interference with by the government and things like free speech and what have you. Get us equal, the equal protection under the law and what have you. How can we pose health care as a right?
Well, I think breathing's a right and living's a right. And if you don't have health care, breathing and living become pretty challenging. The reason we now live into our 80s is because we have a whole modern healthcare system that includes antibiotics and surgery and anti-cancer drugs. So unless you think that people want to go back to an age when you died early and young and died in childbirth because there was no modern healthcare system, if you're alive, healthcare is a right. And most Americans buy that healthcare is a right. Unfortunately, by law, up till the passage of the Affordable Care Act, we bought that in the extreme, which is to say, if you collapse at the emergency room, then we'll take care of you. And that's a pretty stupid way to exercise the right, because by the time you collapse in the emergency room, you're going to be really sick. And the people who are uninsured and go to the emergency room do so with largely with diseases that, if they got early care, would be preventable and be a lot less expensive to take care of. So we have a healthcare system that treats healthcare as a right in the extreme, but with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, it says for the first time that we're going to make healthcare, decent health coverage, affordable health coverage, available to almost everyone in the country.
Well, Richard Kirsch, I certainly agree with that. That answer is a good one, and the one I usually give to people, that's a very practical answer, because it also saves, besides saving lives, it saves money overall, but it's both a philosophical and constitutional question, and certainly the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. We're going to hear about that pretty soon when the Supreme Court rules, but I wonder if you could just speak a little to that. I mean, in terms of what rights are, I mean, certainly humans lived a long time on the planet without the government being part of the healthcare system. So both philosophically and perhaps, philosophically and, if you can, constitutionally, how does that become a right where previously it hasn't been?
Well, from the point of view of the Constitution, it's really not a question of a right. It's really a question of what society decides. So we have national health insurance in this country for seniors. It's called Medicare. It's a national health insurance system. The government basically provides health insurance for everybody in the country who's over 65 through Medicare. The constitutional issue actually is not whether it's a right. It's a very narrow question, which is whether Congress can particularly say that most people have to buy health coverage, if not pay a fine, and whether that fits within the Commerce Clause in the Constitution. Now, the Commerce Clause says that Congress has the ability to regulate commerce between the states, and healthcare is one-sixth of the economy. So in just the most common sense terms, this is pretty clearly within the Constitution's and the Congress's ability to regulate commerce. You had two very conservative appeals court justices rule in favor of that question. The fact that the Supreme Court is even raising it as a serious question, more than anything else, shows how polarized and how really the right wing and the Supreme Court is willing to look at decisions that most people think really aren't constitutional questions, that really are settled law. They did that with the question of corporations being people and whether you could regulate corporate campaign contributions. That was passed back in Teddy Roosevelt's day. No one questioned it, but this very political court questioned it. Hmm. So unfortunately, we have a court that looks like it's putting its own – it's talking about judicial activism. It's very conservative judicial activism. First, there's really no question in terms of settled law that, you know, a decision by the Congress and this huge debate we had with the Congress and the President to say that we're going to say that we're going to try to make health care available to as many people as possible. And part of that we're going to say to folks, if you don't get health care coverage at work and we're going to have a way to have subsidized health care coverage for you, but we're going to ask most people to buy it. And if not, pay a fine if you don't. It's really a tax. It's a different way of doing a tax.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the popular wisdom about how the Supreme Court is going to rule on the Affordable Care Act?
Well, there's the only question, there's almost nobody thinks they're going to overturn the whole law, and none of the appeals court judges did that. The real question is going to be whether they uphold this question of the requirement that most people buy coverage or not. And there's the betting line, the official betting line of InTrade is a 60% chance they'll overturn that. So it's pretty close, but that's the odds are slightly that they'll overturn that.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the law will stay in place, which includes coverage for some 20 million people, a big expansion of Medicaid to a lot of working families. You have the provision now that 2.5 million young people under the age of 26, people like my daughter, are covered under our family policy. Prescription drugs, 3 million senior citizens are paying less for prescription drugs under Medicare because of the Affordable Care Act. There's free preventive care. There's new provisions people probably aren't even aware of, but if you get health coverage at work, for the first time your health care coverage can't stop paying if you get seriously ill because there's no more limits on lifetime payments and there'll be no limits on annual payments. So there's lots of good things in the law that will stay in place even if the court decides that this requirement that most people buy coverage is overturned. One thing that's important for Peter, for people to realize is I totally understand people say, oh, God, I can't be required to buy health insurance. It's much too expensive. Under the current system, that's totally true. But there's two things that are that people don't understand what will happen when this requirement kicks in 2014. First of all, you won't have to pay on your own. There'll be big subsidies based on your income. So if you don't get health coverage at work and you make too much for Medicaid, you'll be able to buy health coverage, but the cost will be based on your income. And for most people, it's going to be very affordable. The second is that the denial of pre-existing conditions, turning people down because they're already sick, that's going to go out too, and that's tied to the mandate. So along with the requirement people buy coverage, again, with a lot of help from the government in terms of buying it, will be no more worrying about being turned down because of a pre-existing condition.
Mm-hmm. Richard Kirsch is my guest. He's written Fighting for Our Health, the epic battle to make health care right in the United States. You can go to fightingforourhealth.com. You can order the book there, see more about it. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Before we go on, and how do you feel about it being called Obamacare? I think in some ways it's a testament to him. On the other hand, it's something that's been manufactured, the label, by the right wing.
You know, we're proud of Obamacare, and the president has realized too. The right wing came up with it as a way of trying to attack the legislation, but it's an extraordinary accomplishment, and it really is a legacy. You know, when Mitt Romney, first of all, it's ironic, Romneycare is really the same as Obamacare. And It's very successful in Massachusetts. 98% of people in Massachusetts have health care coverage, 99.5% of kids. More employers are providing coverage than they did before the law was passed in Massachusetts. Health care costs are starting to go down compared to neighboring states. Fewer people in the emergency room. And it's very popular. So, you know, RomneyCare works. Obamacare is going to work. The irony here that Romney got it from Massachusetts, but because of cowing to right-wing politics, he wants to deny it to the rest of the country. And, Peter, one thing that I got to remind people about, if there are 32 million people who are covered under Obamacare starting in 2014 when the main part of the law kicks in, that's 32,000 fewer people will die every year. Hmm. Those who want to repeal Obamacare want to allow 32,000 more people to die every year. For every million people in this country who don't have health insurance, 1,000 people die. And in my book, Fighting for Our Health, I talk about these people. I talk about loved ones who survived losing their brother in one case, losing a mother, a 7-year-old boy losing his mother in one case because she didn't have health insurance. And those people became so angry, they got really to be active in the system and fought for change. And that's a lot of what the book is about, these really gripping stories of how people who lost loved ones, who denied care for pre-existing conditions, got involved to fight for change. And that's why I call the book Fighting for Our Health, because these are people who really fought for our health. And mm-hmm. So when Romney talks about repealing Obamacare and Republicans do that, they're talking about allowing 32,000 more people to die every year, tens of thousands of people to go bankrupt because of medical bankruptcy every year, more than that, hundreds of thousands. And that's what's at stake here.
Well, Richard Kirsch, let me bring to you criticisms from the left, which would include a number of mine. There's a movement, certainly in this country, for a single-payer health plan, which would be what the right calls socialized medicine, which, as we know, is implemented in every other industrial country in the world other than ours. And this compromise, which left out any public option, is pretty much just this big giveaway to the big medical insurance companies.
Well, first of all, it's good to remind everybody in this debate that we already have national health insurance. It's called Medicare for seniors and people with disabilities. We actually have one socialized medical system in the country. It's the Veterans Administration. It's good enough for the Pentagon, for our veterans. They do a great job. So that puts that in relief. Having said that, the legislation that emerged is not that kind of system. It's a system that makes just enough changes in the current system to get almost everyone covered. And the reason that was done is when you come to healthcare, people feel it so personally that they're very wary of change. They know there's a problem, but they're very wary of change. And to tell everybody under 65 that they would have to give up their private health insurance for a national health insurance system, a government health insurance system, would have been just unacceptable to most of the public. And I lived through this in 93, 94. I was very involved in the Clinton fight. I was a single-payer supporter. I really saw the challenge of doing that. So what passed is legislation that it doesn't just turn everything over to the private health insurance industry. If it was, they would have loved it. But the health insurance industry laundered $86 million to the Chamber of Commerce to try to kill the legislation. So you can't make the case they loved it. They think it's a big gift. And that's because it does do new regulations on them. People around the country are going to start getting checks back this summer. $1.3 billion is going to be returned to healthcare consumers because Obamacare forces insurance companies to spend at least 80% of our healthcare dollar on healthcare as opposed to insurance company profits. So that's one regulation. It forces insurance companies to accept everybody regardless of your health condition. If you're sick before, they still have to cover you. No more pre-existing condition exclusions. They can't charge you more because you were sick. So there's a lot of regulations which the health insurance industry doesn't like. They're still going to get new customers, but under a new regulated healthcare system, which they prefer not to operate in.
Well, let's talk, too, about the requirement. Then this is what is in sharp relief in the Supreme Court deciding about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and that is the requirement that you were talking about earlier that requires everyone to have it. And I don't know what the pardon me, I don't know what the limits are, but say you get the subsidy up to $30,000 or $40,000, whatever, say $40,000. Then you make $40,001 and you're getting you don't get any subsidy. So the people that are right at the edge there are going to wind up taking on an expense that they previously didn't have, and they don't like that.
Right. Although it's important to realize it goes up much higher than that. It actually goes up to, for a family of four, by the time it kicks in 2014, it'll be about $90,000
income. Wow.
So it covers people from a technical point of view four times the poverty level, but it's easier to think about as a family of four, around $90,000. So, and then not everyone has to pay. What they have in Massachusetts and what we have in the new in Obamacare is an escape clause. If you have to pay more than a certain percentage of your income, about 8% of your income, for health premiums, you don't have to apply coverage or face a fine. So it's not just a blanket mandate for everybody. Most people will continue to get coverage at work, and a lot of people who are working who are low income will get coverage through Medicaid, and then a lot of moderate and middle income families will have these premiums subsidized, their tax credits to buy insurance, but their tax credits you get in advance. You don't have to wait till your tax bill, so that it's going to be affordable for most people, and that's why it's not this. It would be clearly scary, as I said before, if you just had to go buy health insurance under the current system. But that's not what's going to start in 2014. What's going to start is a system where you get health coverage where the cost is going to be subsidized for most people based on their income.
And if there's not going to be health care courts. You're not going to wind up in a perp walk, are you?
No. What's going to happen is you have to pay a fine. It's not a criminal fine. It's not a violation. It's a penalty, really. I think a penalty, not a fine.
And that would in your taxes? I mean, that's where.
Yeah, through your taxes. That's right. Through taxes. It's going to be like a penalty in your taxes. It's not illegal. It's not like you've done any criminally wrong or misdemeanor or even a parking ticket. It's a penalty on your taxes that you have to pay more. But again, that'll be if you choose not to have health coverage even after paying, even if realizing that the cost of health coverage will be subsidized. And this is why, again, this is not because of Massachusetts, because of Romney Care, this is not new. We know it works. In Massachusetts, very few people pay the fine. Almost everybody gets coverage. 98% of people are covered, mostly through work, some people through Medicaid or the Child Health Insurance Program. And the people in between who don't get coverage at work or through Medicaid go to these new healthcare marketplaces that are regulated. Most of the cost is paid for people through these tax credits, and people pay some out of their pockets. There's some responsibility, but everybody in the workforce is paying something for healthcare too. It's taking the kind of system we have in the workforce where people pay some for health coverage, most of it's paid by their employer, and saying if you're out on your own, we know the same thing for most people where you're going to pay for healthcare some of your pocket, most through the government will pay for most of it so that healthcare is affordable for everybody.
And also when you hear that phrase socialized medicine, I mean, there's all sorts of functions that are socialized. You mentioned a couple, Medicare and Medicaid and the Veterans Administration, but there's also, I mean, the police. We have socialized police. We have socialized fire departments. We have socialized road commission because these are costs that are spread out generally through the population. So it's, like you say, there's not going to be, the police aren't going to be at your door. The book is Fighting for Our Health, The Epic Battle to Make Healthcare a Right in the United States. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Richard Kirsch, and you can go to fightingforourhealth.com. The book is published by the Rockefeller Institute Press at the University of Albany, State University of New York. I was talking about some of the left criticism. The right criticism, right wing criticism is, well, hey, we can't afford this. We're in bad shape right now, and all of a sudden bringing billions of dollars more, that's going to be on the plate of the federal government is going to make the deficit even worse.
Yes, and that's why, President Obama and the Congress were very careful to be sure that all the new costs were paid for. In fact, the official scorekeeper of this, the Congressional Budget Office, makes very, very conservative fiscal estimates, says it will save, cut the federal deficit by about $100 million in the first 10 years, $100 billion. Excuse me, in the first 10 years, it's a big difference, billion versus million. $100 billion in the first 10 years, and it'll do that because it does things like raising the Medicare tax for people who make more than $250,000. It does things like closing a loophole in Medicare that gives big breaks to private insurance companies who are getting rich off Medicare. So it does things to raise money so it pays for itself, and in the first 10 years it'll actually reduce the federal deficit.
Richard Kirsch, before we run out of time, maybe you could give us just a taste of what happened on the Colbert Report when you were on there and how Stephen Colbert ended your appearance on the show. It's quite humorous.
Yes, he said something like, I've been euthanized by a death panel. It was actually the most fun I had the whole time in the campaign, and I talk about the whole story in Fighting for Our Health. But one of the most interesting things about being in the Colbert Report was he asked me fairly what seemed like ridiculous questions, like, if you were in a canoe about to go over a waterfall with a little old lady and health care for all, who would you save? And I said, well, healthcare for all is so big and important, he'd save everybody. But I had, like, people who had never seen the show, some of my family and friends, who said, God, that guy was so conservative. How could you put up with him? We thought he was real. So I guess that's both a testimony to what a good job Stephen Colbert does, also a sort of sad testament to how crazy some of the right-wing commentators are.
It
was fun to do, and afterwards, he talked to me, and he showed a real concern, a deep, really human concern with the lives at stake in this. And he really understood through all the humor. What we're talking about is a system right now where tens of thousands of people die, hundreds of thousands of people go bankrupt because they don't have health coverage, where if you lose your job, you lose your health coverage. You want to start a small business, you can't afford it. All that's is changing, and is going to be fully changed in 2014 if Obama gets reelected and this is not repealed. And that's really at the stakes in the election coming up. And I have to remind people about that. For all this rhetoric and the scare tactics and the death panels, which never existed, which Colbert was joking about with me, saying I'd been euthanized by one, what's really at stake is the fact a country that says, for all the money we spend on health care, let's be sure that everyone in this country has the right to get good health care. And in doing so, we're actually going to save money, because when we get everybody into the health care system, we actually save money. We don't end up paying tons of money for people who are really sick. An ounce of prevention really is worth a pound of cure.
Now, we have our neighbor to the south here, believe it or not, Canada. We have a prime minister, very conservative, would never think about touching the Canadian National Health Program. The conservative prime minister of Britain, the same thing. Why are we so unique, and why wouldn't corporations be right there at the front saying, hey, let's have the government pay for it so we don't have to pay for it? I never understood that.
It is hard to understand. I mean, our healthcare system puts us at a huge competitive disadvantage, and particularly now that we're in a global economy. And you have lots of examples, actually, of companies in the United States who've set up operation in Canada because they can save money on healthcare and still get their goods to market easily. We spend so much more because we don't include everybody in the system and because we don't share the costs equitably. Why have large businesses been reluctant to adopt that? A lot of it's because they just can't see beyond their own business model. First of all, they like providing benefits to their workers. They see it as a way to attract workers. And second of all, they just can't imagine a different kind of system because they're so stuck in the American system that they don't give credence to anything outside the rest of the world.
Richard Kirsch, let me do this because we got a minute left. What should listeners be doing if they want to retain the Affordable Care Act?
A good place to start is to go to the website for the organization Healthcare for America Now. I tell the story of building that and fighting for our health. But it continues to work. I'm not there anymore, but they do a great job still. It's called, go to healthcareforamericanow.org. You can get involved. It'll keep you abreast of what's going on. Plug you in with local groups. In Michigan, there's a group called Michigan Citizen Action, which is doing a great job of organizing people to defend the Affordable Care Act. You can look up Michigan Citizen Action on their website. And again, you know, I'd love people to come to hear this whole story, and really the story of how individuals still can make a huge difference in this country, still can take on powerful interests and win. And that's the story I tell in Fighting for Our Health.
Yeah, and we really didn't get into a lot of the book itself and the stories that it tells. Howard Dean, the former governor of Vermont, says, finally, a book about the intrigue and politics in Washington that has relevance for Americans outside the Beltway, written by someone who is actually in a position to know what really happened. And indeed, he did, and it's chronicled in Richard Kirsch's book, Fighting for Our Health, The Epic Battle to Make Healthcare a Right in the United States. You can go to fightingforourhealth.com to order the book. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Richard Kirsch, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Thank you, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit
Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I wonder if you ever heard this word, iatrogenesis, without even spelling it or anything like that. Essentially, it means doctor-created illness. In every profession, there's mistakes, and sometimes doctors make mistakes. But human error, I don't even know if it can be avoided. But when we think about our health care in the United States, some of us think the healthcare system doesn't rank very well in the world because so many people are excluded from it. But almost all of us say that the healthcare, what we get when we go into a doctor's office, into a hospital, is just world class, the best in the world. Well, this is sort of a frightening book. It's called First Do Less Harm, Confronting the Inconvenient Problems of Patient Safety. And the editors are Suzanne Gordon and Ross Koppel. And Suzanne Gordon has been on our show any number of times. She wrote Life Support and also Nursing Against the Odds. I think that's when we picked up on Suzanne Gordon. She's the co-author of Safety in Numbers, also From Silence to Voice. She's the editor of When Chicken Soup Isn't Enough. I know we talked to her about that one. Co-editor of The Complexities of Care. And the book, First Do Less Harm, it chronicles and brings to the reader 12 healthcare professionals and researchers and also two former patients, and they look at patient safety from a variety of different perspectives. And the solutions that are often proposed, they find inadequate or impractical. It all scares me, but let's talk to Suzanne Gordon. Again, welcome back to the broadcast, Suzanne.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
Sure, we're reaching her in her office in Richmond, California. What do you think about what I said about do we have the best health care once we arrive at the doctor's office in the hospital?
No, we actually don't. We actually rank 37th on a whole number of different parameters.
Whoa!
Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development countries. We're sort of just ahead of Singapore, I think. I can't remember, but the subject that we're dealing with here, and the book is not intended to scare you to death, you know, but really to help people think through what's left out of the patient safety discussion. Listeners probably recall that in 1999, the Institute of Medicine, which is a very prestigious body in Washington, did a big study called they did a big study on patient safety and medical errors and injuries that was called To Err Is Human, and they chronicled that there are about 98,000 fatalities from medical errors and injuries in the United States every year, and that may actually even be a conservative estimate. So iatrogenic really is a word for kind of medical or, you know, almost system-created problems, and these can, the average patient in a hospital has one medication error a day, and if hopefully somebody will be there to catch it. But there's all kinds of reasons why we have these problems, and why in the past 10 years since, in more than 10 years since the IOM report To Err Is Human came out, and then that was followed by another report called Crossing the Quality Chasm, there hasn't been really enough progress. And so we really are looking at why hasn't there been the kind of progress that there should have been in patient safety after this, you know, huge media blitz and huge attention on these solutions. And the title of the book comes from the Hippocratic Oath and from Florence Nightingale, who both said, and separated by many centuries, that the duty of the system and the people who practice in it is to first do no harm. And we're saying, my co-editor Ross Koppel and I are saying, well, listen, if you can't do no harm, at least do less harm. And, the perfect can sometimes be the enemy of the good. And let's have a good enough patient safety, because we don't have a good enough patient safety now. Healthcare and many hospitals are not what are considered or called high reliability industries. And, you know, there's a lot of focus on the patient and on the patient, you know, kind of knowing enough to protect themselves. Well, the reality is when you're a patient, you're walking into kind of Mars. You know, you're walking into a foreign country. I mean, it's almost like going to outer space sometimes. And sometimes people look like they're wearing spacesuits. And, you know, you just can't protect yourself. I mean, half the time you're unconscious, you're zonked out on drugs, you're terrified, et cetera. So we talk about how people who work in the system can better organize it. And we focus on a lot of different issues that really aren't enough, in our view, in the patient safety debate. And we've rounded up a whole bunch of really incredibly prominent healthcare policy people, researchers in healthcare who look at different issues from the problem of doctors and nurses not getting enough sleep to lack of teamwork to unrealistic expectations that Medicare and Medicaid services sometimes, rules they sometimes promulgate, mm-hmm. to the promise of health information technology, you know, all this stuff that is in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, where they're putting in a lot of money on computerized technology, and that's seen as the silver bullet. And we're saying, wait a minute, you know, there actually is no silver bullet. There's a lot of, in fact, there is no bullet, and there shouldn't be. Bullet is a really bad thing to have in a hospital or in a healthcare system. And so we're saying, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that you need to think about if we really want to have safety in patient care and if we want to do much less harm on the way to doing no harm.
My guest is Suzanne Gordon. She's a co-editor of First Do Less Harm, Confronting the Inconvenient Problems of Patient Safety. You can go to SuzanneCGordon.com. The book will be there, a lot more information. And I was remiss in introducing Suzanne Gordon to not say that she's a visiting professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing and was program leader of the Robert Wood Johnson-funded Nurse Manager in Action program, so she knows of which she speaks.
Hopefully. And yeah. Also, I'm a patient, and I've had some pretty awful.
Yeah, me too. I almost got killed in the emergency room. I was brought in. I don't want to, you know, give the whole story, but they misdiagnosed what I had, gave me something that they thought was critical at the moment, and that almost put me out permanently. But
yeah.
Can we ever get away from that? I mean, boom, it's right at the instant there, and it's human error. I mean,
I think that one of the things that needs to happen is much more admission of human error. And also, one of the essays that I did in the book is about teamwork and what I call team intelligence. And, you know, there's all this stuff about emotional intelligence out there in hospitals today, but what we really need is team intelligence. And the problem is that we really don't have teamwork in hospitals, and you have to have people empowered who are, you know, everyone from the janitor to the brain surgeon, right? And the nurse and the physical therapist, people have to be able to say to somebody, whoops, you're making a mistake, because usually in a hospital, when there's an error like you describe or what I describe, there's a whole group of people that are disempowered from saying, you know, well, we think actually this might be the wrong way to go, or this might be a problem in the making, and they are afraid to speak up because they are really slapped down by the system if they say anything. And one of the essays in the book is a really very powerful essay about what happens to nurses when there's a medical error or injury to a patient and they've known that something bad was happening and they'd been sidelined and nobody would listen to them. And they are, you know, they have what the authors call wounds that won't heal. A lot of times these errors happen because people are basically sort of sleepwalking in the hospital. I mean, we have two essays in the book, one by Christopher Landrigan, who's done the primary work on doctors' hours and doctors working too long hours and errors. And then we have another essay by Linda Allison Trinkoff and Jean Geiger Brown at the University of Maryland School of Nursing, and their work is on nurses and fatigue. And you know, I don't know what happened to you, but certainly people who are up too long are going to miss a whole lot of things. And we now have doctors who are working 80-hour week, and that is considered to be an advance. Residents and interns, doctors in training, their hours are now 80 hours a week. They're down from 100 plus.
Yeah, how can that be allowed? I mean, that seems
well,
so...
Well, and that's considered to be an advance.
Oh, I know, I know. That's the reform.
And let me tell your listeners, because if, I mean, this is a very hard thing to do to ask your doctor or nurse, but, you know, when you go to the hospital and when somebody suggests an elective procedure, one of the questions patients should ask, and they shouldn't have to ask these kind of questions because it should be ruled out from the beginning, is how long have you been up? You know, when you, yeah. I mean, if you're gonna operate on me, you know, at 5 in the afternoon, what time did you get up in the morning and what time did you get to sleep the night before?
Probably three thirty. He got up or she got
up,
right?
You know, I mean, I've seen, I mean, and there's been a huge focus on doctor's hours. Now, mind you, the focus on doctor's hours has been on doctors and training hours. And there's been no focus in the United States, at least, unlike in Western Europe and Australia and the United Kingdom and so forth. There's been no focus on regular, you know, once you kind of a grown-up doctor and you've passed, you know, the test, these doctors in the U.S. and Canada, they can work, I mean, they can work as long as they want. Now, you know, pilots have hour restrictions.
Sure.
They can't, you know, work for more than 8 hours. Truck drivers, I mean, except apparently those on oil doing oil tankers.
Which are crashing all the time.
Yeah, yeah, which are crashing all the time because of that. But doctors, you know, regular doctors can work as many hours as they want. So your surgeon could have been up for 17 hours and, you know, gotten 4 hours of sleep a night for the past 5 days. There's nothing to restrict that. And your nurse, it used to be that nurses worked 8-hour days, and now nurses are working 12-plus hour shifts. And one of the issues that we take up, and you know, we're very supportive of unions in the book, and one of the things that we say is in one of the essays in the book is that hospitals should involve unions much more in patient safety, unions of frontline workers in patient safety initiatives in the implementation and design implementation and evaluation, as opposed to just coming in and saying from on high, you know, okay, you're going to change and do it now, hop to it. But one of the big problems in nursing unions is they have not taken up the challenge of going back to the 8-hour day, because a lot of nurses like to work, you know, 3 12-hour shifts.
Sure.
Which is never just 12 hours. And we know that 12-hour shifts are really dangerous both to patients and to nurses. And you know, I know nurses who, you know, get up at 5 in the morning, drive 1.5 hours to work, get to work at, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning, finish at 7 at night, and drive 1.5 hours back home, and there's no restrictions on that, and they can work as many of those kind of days as they want. And, you know, the reality is, when you ask people who are tired, I mean, a lot of nurses think they're safe. You know, they don't know that they're really unsafe. Geiger Brown and Trinkoff have actually put, you know, little watches, wrist watches on nurses, and these watches detect microsleep. And a lot of nurses are falling asleep on the job. You know, it's like they fall asleep for an instant or, you know, some seconds, and then they wake up. They don't even know they've just fallen asleep. They get into accidents. They, you know, it's a very dangerous practice. I mean, people fought for centuries for the 8-hour day and the 40-hour week for a reason.
Yeah, you know, and, a friend of ours who's a heart critical care unit nurse, she routinely works 12 to 14 hours. And I always think, well, for instance, I had to go in for an optical procedure. And I said, how many does he do a day? She said, well, about 30. And I said, I want to be in the first five, you know. And she kind of laughed and said, yeah, okay, we can do that. But I'm thinking, what about the poor guy or gal that didn't ask? You know, I'm sure he didn't blind anybody or mess anything up that day. But, you know, it's just sort of the more you do, the more capacity for accident. But that gets to the profit motive. I mean, if you do 30 eye surgeries a day, you're reaping a pretty good income.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think the larger profit issue is that as marketization has increased in healthcare, there's just more pressure on everybody. I mean, whether it's a nurse, a doctor, a lab tech, you know, produce more and more and more, work longer hours, you know, read more x-rays, you know, read more tests. And, you know, the human body, I mean, the brain has limits, right? And we don't respect those limits. You know, I mean, we didn't put this in the book, but, you know, one of the traditional things that that doctors and nurses and people in healthcare don't do is eat, like lunch or breaks. And, you know, it actually turns out that they've done brain studies on people who are hungry, and they're cranky, irritable, and have bad judgment and are very negative. And, you know, we want empathy from doctors or nurses, and we know also that fatigue creates irritability. So we have people routinely in healthcare who are dealing with the sick and the vulnerable who are overworked, seeing too many patients or doing too many whatevers, mm-hmm. And are hungry. And we want them to be nice to us. Well, the brain can't do it. You know, it's sort of like asking a car to drive an extra 100 miles with an empty gas tank.
Wow.
You can't, you know, the car, like, it ain't going to do it, you know. You're not going anywhere here.
Sure.
And we ask human beings to do that, and guess what? They're not. Now, there are a lot of solutions to this. I mean, one of the big things that we look at in the book.
Suzanne, let me just interrupt you 1 second. I want to just reintroduce you to people that may, you know, have just joined us. The book is First Do Less Harm, Confronting the Inconvenient Problems of Patient Safety. And it is co-edited by Suzanne Gordon, my guest, and Ross Koppel. You can go to Suzanne Z, you know why I do that.
SuzanneCGordon.com.
Thank you. SuzanneCGordon.com. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And the book consists of 12 healthcare professionals and researchers plus former patients talking about patient safety. You know, you also have a book called The Complexities of Care. And it seems that there's two things that here that are seem to be at work here. We're talking about stressed personnel, but also just this incredibly complex medical system. It doesn't seem like there's if people have to work 80 hours, it doesn't seem like there's enough people involved, for one thing. Is that right?
Well, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, in my view, we need, you know, more doctors and nurses nurses need to be paid more, but doctors maybe less. I don't know, you know.
Uh-oh.
I mean, I don't want to get into that. I mean, one of the big, you know, things that should be on the table, and the book doesn't, you know, deal with that, but I'm going to just say it, is that, you know, I think that we need to have free education for physicians and nurses and other healthcare personnel in this country, and just sort of take the issue of medical school debt off the table. But I mean, I think that we need, I mean, the reality is, it's a very complex issue. You know, hospitals are trying and healthcare institutions are trying to get more for less out of people. We've sort of marketized healthcare. I mean, one of the chapters in the book that's a very important chapter is written by my co-editor, Ross Koppel. And he's looked at, and his colleagues, and he's looked at the use of healthcare information technology as this kind of, which is being promoted as this silver bullet for patient safety. Now, I don't know how many of your listeners have had the same experience that I have, but, you know, now you go into a doctor's office or you're, you know, you see your doctor and they're not looking at you. They're looking at what they're typing into the screen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you see nurses in hospitals, you know, spending more time taking care of the computer than the patient. And there's been this huge push, largely by for-profit corporations that sell this technology. And, you know, they promise the world, they kind of overload it. And what happens is, you know, there's all kinds of problems with this technology. And basically, you know, I mean, people are putting things in computers and assuming that because it's in the computer that somebody's reading it, you know, a doctor writes an order or a note and assumes that, you know, the nurse is reading the order or note because it's, they just put it in. Well, you know, there's all kinds of alarm fatigue because there's all these alarms going off. And, you know, the technology is incredibly expensive. There's all this hype. These hospitals are buying the technology and spending millions of dollars on this technology. And there's a real disincentive and a real pressure on people to not say anything bad about it and to sort of get on the program. And this really important article in the book, a chapter in the book, really details all the problems that this technology is creating. Now, that's not to say that we don't need technology, but, you know, the problem with a for-profit healthcare system, which ours largely is that there's a real disincentive to improve the technology, to have a technology that is really sort of worker-friendly.
Suzanne Gordon, let's do this. Excuse me for interrupting, but I see that we're almost out of time, and I wanted to just, we've got about 3 minutes left. First, what's at work? Are there villains, or is the model flawed? And then the second...
Well, I think it's... Go ahead.
And then I also want you to suggest some solutions, but we got about 3 minutes, so we...
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that we should be out there sort of scanning the world for villains, but, you know, I think we need to look at the assumptions that we're basing our solutions on. We really need to have a culture of safety that includes frontline workers, includes unions. We have to have a culture of safety that really allows staff to constantly report dangerous actions or omissions, you know, that rates managers and team leaders on whether they maintain a non-punitive environment that keeps relationships positive between teams and among team members. People at the very bottom have to be able to question the authority of the people at the very top and really draw attention to anything that is going wrong or be able to present their ideas because they know the work better than somebody at the very top of the organization. We really have to look at the relationship between for-profit companies like these healthcare information technology companies and hospitals and really use healthcare information technology much more. And we just can't, I don't think we can solve this problem by applying an industrial model to healthcare. It just makes things worse. Patients aren't widgets. We're not consumers. You know, we're vulnerable, we're anxious, we're frightened, and we need to consider what is the nature of the work that a nurse does, a doctor does with a vulnerable and frightened human being. And we have to not entirely depend on machines. I mean, we have to look at what is the human body capable of? What are these people who work with sick people capable of? I mean, like, how about having lunch? What a novel idea.
Yeah, yeah.
What about getting, like, a couple more hours sleep?
Could that help?
You know,
well, these all seem common sense, and
yeah,
unfortunately,
but let me tell you,
quickly, though, we're out of time.
Science and healthcare.
Yeah.
Well, it's all in this book. If you're a patient, if you're a medical professional, grab this book. It discusses the issues that are so critical to us as a patient, but also to health professionals as well. The book is First, Do Less Harm, Confronting the Inconvenient Problems of Patient Safety. It's edited by Suzanne Gordon and Ross Capel. And you can go to SuzanneCGordon.com, and the book will be there and other writings of Suzanne. You go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. As usual, Suzanne Gordon, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Oh, great. And I just want to mention one other website. It's BedsideMannersThePlay.com, which is a play about teamwork, and people might be interested in learning about that. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Oh, look, here's some breaking news.
Back to the Rock on the Riff.